Hi, everybody. We're live. Sorry, what are you saying?
Are you back at the normal homestead now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're all beach all the way.
All beach all the time. That's the way we like it around these parts. Mm-hmm.
So I have a very, very mini topic that is so small I decided to use it now as a pre-show because it's stupid.
Uh-huh. All right, everyone, look at the clock. Let's see how this one goes. All right, carry on.
All right, so I've decided that I should read more. And
I'm here for this. You read all day.
You're always staring at the computer screen. There's words all over it.
Well, you know, it's funny. Like, you know, for somebody who used to make a service that was primarily about reading things.
That was about reading things later, not now.
Right.
Important distinction.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I haven't really used it in a long time. And I just started again recently because I just have not really been reading web articles and stuff. And I mean, frankly, the web is a dumpster fire, and there aren't that many articles that I really intend to save and read from the web these days. Which
you should make an app that makes it easier to read those without all the ads and junk in them.
You should do that.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, by the way, God, Apple News is such a crappy experience because there's just giant, horrible ads like every two paragraphs. Oh my God! Like, and even like I recently mentioned in brief a while ago that I started paying for a New York Times subscription because I was tired of like rationing how often I would click on their links and it felt stupid. And it is also a terrible experience. Like I pay for this, I pay for that, and I pay for Apple News, and you know through iCloud Plus or whatever. And both of them just fill the experience with ads constantly. It's awful. Like no wonder nobody reads stuff on the web anymore. Because they ruined it. Like it's a terrible experience. Like, and even when you pay for it, you can give the money, and it's still full of horrible ads. Like every two paragraphs, it's ridiculous. Anyway, setting that aside, I've decided I should read more. Just not that, but you know, maybe the occasional book or you know longer articles or whatever. And because I've kind of like lost my attention span for reading, and it's very difficult. And I thought that's probably not good for myself overall. So anyway, decided to read more, and I decided what I should try again is an e-reader because I have used e-readers in the past. I have really enjoyed using them. I spent a lot of time using them. I have, in the meantime, since mailed them all to John Siracusa as packing material for other objects that are more useful. But e-readers are really inexpensive, and they've come a long way. And I figured, let me give one a shot. So I got the, at first I tried to get, there's this brand called Books with an X on the end, B-O-O-X, that they make these fairly interesting e-reader tablets that are basically Android tablets and with the full Google Play Store available. So it's an Android tablet with an e-ink screen. And so you can run, like, so I thought, like, what, wouldn't that be interesting? I could, like, run the Instapaper app. And even I could run the Kindle app in case I don't like their built-in bookstore or whatever. So I could do that, but still have the benefits of an e-reader, which, you know, I really do enjoy e-ink as a screen technology. I like the way it looks. I like reading from it. It has a lot of advantages in terms of battery life and a lot of versatility with things like, you know, viewing outdoors. And so I thought that, you know, that could be really promising. You know, one of the places I've read is in the summer on the ferry, where I'm often sitting on the roof of the ferry outside in direct sunlight, and it's somewhat difficult to read, you know, an iPad or iPhone screen in direct sunlight, especially while you're wearing sunglasses, and when the polarizing direction of the screen is like the wrong way for your sunglasses, so it makes it even dimmer. No. Anyway, so I thought let me try a modern e-reader to see. You know, it's been a number of years since I've had one. Let me see what they're like today, if they've gotten any better. And short version is, they're still really weird. So,
wait, so which books thing did you get? Do you know the model name offhand?
So I decided to get one. I did not know this existed at all. I decided to try the color one, which is not color e-ink. That's something else that is not really widespread yet. The color, it's the Books. Geez, I think it's the Air Color 2. They have a bunch of item names that are all very, very, very similar to each other. I ordered this thing, and it was a long back order time on their website, but Amazon sold it. Great. Order it. I get it, and the box is suspiciously light. And the box is just its cover, which I didn't even order, and not the device.
Oh God.
So I sent it back. The long wait. I'm like, fine. Let me, you know what? Screw this. Let me just try a Kindle. And so I got the latest Kindle Oasis because I really enjoyed the last one before I, you know, stopped using it for 5 years and then sent it to John Siracusa. So so anyway, I thought, let me get the latest Oasis, see what's new with these things. So the answer is not a lot is new. In fact, they're actually worse than they used to be because certain features that I used to enjoy, like the old like magazine newsstand thing built in, are gone now. Like they just stopped doing them. So like there's certain things like I just, you know, if you want like, you know, the daily, you know, say the New York Times delivered to your Kindle, like that used to be a thing that they would make in a custom format, and it was actually really nice. It was a nice experience if you were willing to pay for it. And as far as I can tell, that's mostly or entirely gone now. That whole program that they've discontinued, their entire like newsstand program, it's all gone now. And some of those things you can get in various ways, most of them you can't, and the experience for all of them is worse now. Also, the Kindle software in general has just gotten more complicated. The experience is first of all, it's really slow to navigate stuff. And I forget whether it was always that slow or whether it's gotten more bloated over time.
Always. I mean, I haven't used a modern one. I'm trying to figure out what the heck version of the Kindle I have. But I can tell you that my Kindle, and I think the first one I ever had, which Stephen Hackett sent to me, but I had briefly used Aaron's, and she's had Kindles on and off for years, and hers were always dog slow. Mine is dog slow. It's just part of the experience is just it being dog slow.
Yeah, and I, to be fair, I'm not just talking about like the e-ink refresh. Like that's fine. I'm okay with that. I accept that. I've lived with that for a long time. It's fine. I'm talking about like you push a button, 1, 2, 3, then the screen flashes and does something. It's like even simple things like waking up the device from sleep takes forever. Like it's really a pretty poor experience. And as they've moved them all towards being touch screens and touch first UIs, I think that has not helped them in a lot of ways. That they now have like things that I've been spoiled by in Apple world. Like I'm trying to hold the Kindle to read with it, and occasionally the edge of my hand will just slightly register as a touch on the edge of the screen, and that will make me lose my page. And that, even though it has page turn buttons, I spent the ridiculous sum of money to get the one model they offer with page turn buttons, but there's no option, as far as I could tell, to disable tap to page. So you have page turn buttons that you can use, but you can also tap the screen whether you mean to or not. And so you end up losing your page a lot, and that's really frustrating, which I think removes a lot of the value of the Kindle Oasis, because the whole point of it is make the thing really super small on three sides so you can hold it. Anyway, it's every Amazon Kindle I've ever gotten has been a frustration experience of like, I love 75% of this, and then they just fall over on what seem like things that could be really basic settings or small implementation changes, and they just don't do it, and because they just don't. Amazon's not good at making things nice. They're good at making things cheap. They're not good at making things nice. So I decided, I think I might return the Kindle Oasis. Meanwhile, then the books thing pops back in stock, and I'm like, let me give it a shot. What the heck? So I reordered the books thing, got my, you know, the whole shipping mistake from the previous one handled, and I got the books thing. It is even weirder than I could have possibly imagined. So first of all, the like half of the interface, it ends up, you know, it's a Chinese company, and the interface is in English, but a lot of the interface that you run into ends up dropping back to Chinese because they didn't localize that part of it. And, you know, stuff like, you know, some of the boot screens, sometimes you'll end up seeing a wall of Chinese. I'm like, well, I don't really understand this. I don't really know what to do here. The firmware update, like the update notes will all be in Chinese. It's like, well, I don't really know what I'm doing, what I'm agreeing to. So that was a little odd. But the good thing about the books thing is that the color screen kind of works. So the way they do color, I think the way they do it is there is a regular black and white e-ink screen below, and then on top of that they layer on a layer of LCD a little bit.
What?
So that you could, the e-ink, like, you know, shines through, you know, is reflected through it. It's a weird hybrid, and it ends up making the screen really dim and low contrast, and the colors are not at all vibrant. They're very, very, like, you know, low saturation, like very basic colors. It almost looks like you took a picture of an old box of Crayola crayons and ran it through like a sepia filter. So like those are the colors you're getting, like really like dull basic colors. And it is everything about the Books tablet made the Kindle feel like you just discovered SSDs for the first time. Like, the Kindle, I thought, was god slow. Oh my god, the Books tablet, everything is even slower, to the point where, like, you tap something and you might wait 10 seconds before it then updates the screen to go to wherever, whatever you navigated. Like, and it's not, you know, this is simple stuff like navigating to the library and you know, between pages of, you know, screens of apps or whatever. It's rough. Like, it's really rough. I will say I was impressed by the handwriting. So the Books thing has a pen, and it has pen support, like a stylus, very similar to the Apple Pencil, but, you know, more basic version. And it has, like, a, you know, drawing app, and I'm sure there's a few more in the Play Store if you want. But there's one that comes with it, and it's surprisingly responsive. I was very impressed. Like, I know there's a tablet called the Remarkable that's been around for a while that I frequently get Instagram ads for. I've never bought it because I don't really do a lot of handwriting stuff. But if I was, like, a note taker, I would probably strongly consider it. But anyway, so I didn't get that. But anyway, going back. So this device was infuriating because it was like, okay, it's an Android tablet. That's exactly as good as you think it will be. Add e-ink on top of that. I thought it was going to be really cool, and it really wasn't. Now, while all this was going on, I happened to also be refreshing my test device fleet. As I mentioned last week, I got an iPhone SE refurb because I needed a phone to pair with Adam's watch, and I didn't have an SE, so I thought, well, what the heck? Because all of my old test devices for, like, you know, keep this thing on iOS 15, keep this thing on iOS 16, like, all my old test devices aged out at iOS 15, that none of them can run 16, because they're all, like, you know, the iPhone SE, the iPhone 7, like, I couldn't, the old SE. So anyway, so I kind of needed a couple new test devices. And because we're about to enter beta season, so I want to have, like, a set of devices I can put on all the new betas without disrupting my main stuff. And then at the end of the summer, be able to keep a set of devices, whatever it is, keep one set of devices on iOS 16 and watch OS 9 and whatever else. So that way, when I update my main device to those, I have those test devices still. Because in the past, I haven't had that, and it has worked against me a lot. it's been a problem sometimes. Anyway, so I needed a couple more test devices. And I happen to need, for beta purposes, an iPad. Because all of our iPads have either been given to family members or are currently in use or, you know, whatever. So I didn't have an iPad that I could use for beta use. Also, Overcast sucks on the new iPad mini. It's horrible. There's so many weird layout bugs that I have on the iPad mini. I really need to fix it. So I thought, let me look around. I got a good refurb deal on an iPad mini from Amazon, and it is it's like the identical size of the Books, whatever tablet I got. It's like same size, a little bit heavier, but otherwise, like, same, you know, same rough dimensions. And I thought, why don't I just set up this iPad mini? Since I have to have it as a test device, why don't I set up the iPad mini as an e-reader, basically? Like, so it doesn't have my Apple ID. It has my test Apple ID signed into it. So none of my stuff is there. I can't, like, message or check my email from it. Like, none of that's there. So there's no distraction. It only has on it the Overcast version I'm testing with, which is not my real account. So it doesn't even have the podcast I want, like, you know, signed in and everything. And then I put on it the Kindle app. I signed into my Kindle account. I put on it the New York Times app, Apple News, and Instapaper. And all those are sort of, like, that's all signed into my real account, but then nothing else is there. So I've created an e-reader out of an iPad mini. And you know what? It's better than the other. It's way better than the Books. And it's even better than the Kindle in most circumstances. Not all. You know, if I was reading it in direct sunlight on the top of the ferry, the Kindle is still better for that. But it's actually way better in most cases as an e-reader. There are more options. There's more customization to be had. It's way more responsive. You get all of Apple's built-in, like, palm rejection, you know, making sure you don't have erroneous touches. Like, all of that's built in. It is just so much nicer, and it was so much faster to set up, so much easier to manage. You know, the battery life is not going to be as good as a Kindle. And again, the, you know, direct sunlight viewing is not going to be as good. It isn't water resistant the way a Kindle is. But man, it is, like, Apple has ruined me for these devices. Like, I try the other things, and, like, this is, like, the flagship Kindle. This is a brand new device from this other, you know, weird company. And it's no contest compared to an iPad mini that was actually fairly close to them in price.
Why don't you try the Kobo? Kobo
is
Jason's favorite. I just I'll put a link in the show notes to his most recent e-reader roundup, which was, I think, 2021, but I think he picked Kobo as his top. Kobo is book spelled backwards. That's a joke from The Incomparable.
Oh, wait, no, it's not.
That's a joke from The Incomparable.
Well, For a second, I believed you. I was like, wait, that explains everything. But I was going to say the
joke
exact same thing.
From The Incomparable. People who get it. People who don't.
Yeah. I should credit Jason, because I've read the Six Colors articles on e-readers every time he publishes them. And I did refer back to them when making these decisions and trying these things out. And I think he came to the same conclusions about the books that I did, basically. But he cares a lot more than I do about this stuff. And he has way more experience with these things. I have never tried a Kobo. And part of that is, like, you know, I figure, like, if I'm gonna have a non iPad reader, I figure, well, Kindle is probably best because it has the ecosystem. Also, for whatever it's worth, I really like the old default Kindle font, PMN Cecilia. I love that font, and that font is available in all of the Kindle apps on other platforms and on real Kindles themselves, labeled Cecilia. And I don't think any other reading app offers it. And so I kind of, like, I'm a snob in certain ways. I love reading with that font, like, long stuff. So I even miss it when I'm using Instapaper because they don't have it. Like, I should have put it in there, damn it, like, back when I had it. But anyway, so, you know, Kobo, where Kobo is better, I think, in Jason's experience, is I believe it offers more option to not have force-justified text. And this is the biggest area where Kindles fall down. Kindles do not offer you the option to have non-justified text all the time. Sometimes they offer it, but not all the time. It is based on some kind of, like, certain content it's available, certain content it isn't, probably because of some weird detail about, like, the weird Mobi format they were using and whether the publisher has enabled some other flag in the EPUB or whatever. Like, it's probably some weird reason like that. Bottom line, though, is that with a Kindle, you oftentimes are forced to take force justification. And it's really hard to read stuff that way. So, for a device devoted to reading, you'd expect it to have a really great reading experience, and it kind of doesn't in a lot of cases, which is unfortunate. So Kobo is better, I think, in those areas, but I kind of don't want to lose the ecosystem advantage that I get from Amazon. You know, I already have a sum of a library from Amazon, but, you know, ultimately, if I just keep reading on my iPad mini, I have access to everything. I have access to Apple Books. I have the Kindle app itself, which the Kindle app offers almost the same reading experience as hardware Kindle devices, but with smoother animations and, you know, faster responsiveness and, you know, higher resolution for images and stuff like that. Like, it's actually a better experience. All that is to say, I've tried e-readers again. I think if I read a lot of novels while sitting in bathtubs or pools, I would love the Kindles. As it is now, the iPad mini actually solves my needs better.
So I'm glad you phrased it exactly that way, because for me, now granted, I'm on an older Kindle. I'm on, I think, the original Paperwhite. I'm not entirely sure, to be honest with you, but apparently, according to Amazon, I registered it with Amazon in 2016, and I don't think it was new at that point. So whatever I have, it's old. And it is slow, but I love reading novels on this. I don't read anything else but novels. So I think you and I have kind of polar opposite needs. I do read novels on the beach when I go to the beach in the summer. I don't live there, so it's a very rare occurrence. But what I love about my Kindle is that I can always read on my Kindle, and it is always comfortable. I have crummy eyes, and so I crank the font size up to hilarious. It's ridiculous how big I have the font, but I do that so this way, whether or not I have my contact lenses in, so for example, if I'm trying to go to sleep, I might read for a little bit, but I don't have my contacts in at that point, I can still look at the Kindle in bed. And when I'm
reading, just to look at your Kindle screen with the font cranked up to see if you can fit more words than I could fit on my 160 by 160 palm screen that I read books on. You know what I mean? Like, I do wonder if the total number of words is actually similar. It's just yours is seven times as big.
I mean, I'm exaggerating somewhat, but not that much, because pretty much anytime anyone looks at my Kindle, especially people who have Kindles, they're like, oh, my God. what's wrong with your font? No, it's that's how I like it. But anyway, I love having the Kindle. It's there's no chance for distraction. I understand what you're saying, Marco, that you've kind of built yourself a similar situation, but there's no chance for distraction. I can use it at night and it has its own backlight, but it can get super crazy dim. I can use it in direct light. I couldn't agree with you more, Marco, that I love the reading experience of e-ink. It feels so much more like, well, not literally feels, but it gives you that you know, figurative feel that's much more like paper. I love my Kindle, and if it broke, I would replace it with either another Kindle, again, for ecosystem reasons, like Marco was saying, or I would at least try this Kobo thing and see what I thought. But I can't imagine that I personally would enjoy an iPad mini for this specific task. I can see how you landed there, but for me, give me e-ink all day, every day, because that is so much more comfortable to read, in my personal opinion. Well, how long was that, though? It was about 20 minutes? That was your quick, super quick mini topic?
Yeah, super quick. Just had a little bit to say.
Excellent. Go team. All right, so we're going to make up for that by telling you for the second time that the merch store is open. Hooray! The merch store is back.
The merch store. Please. Let's not sully it with this terrible name. It's the ATP store. The ATP store has returned. Time was that Casey would herald the return to the ATP store, but now he keeps saying merch, and I don't know why.
Do you want to take this, John?
No. ATP store, please.
The ATP, don't call it merch. Don't call it merchandise. It's just the ATP store. It's back, baby.
That's right.
Sorry, Dad. The offending party's been sacked.
I'm trying to consistency in branding, you know?
Nevertheless, the store is back. We have a couple of offerings. We have the Mac Pro Believe shirt, which we're going to talk a little bit more about in a moment. Suffice to say, it is the top of the modern Mac Pro with the word Believe beneath it. Then we have the ATP Six Colors logo, and we have that in monochrome on very several flavors of material. We also have the OG rainbow logo on black. Additionally, we have brought back from the ATP vault the Pro Max Triumph shirt, which has all six of the Pro Max that through the years in profile in multicolored ink, and you can do that in white or black fabric. Last I looked, I think there might be a handful of mugs left. We also brought back the ATP polo. You're welcome for the six of you that really, really like it, of which I'm one of them. And the ATP hoodie is back. So if you need to perhaps re-up your hoodie, I wear mine so darn much that I'm probably going to get a backup just to be safe. All of these are available for you at atp.fm/store. Now, members, remember, you get 15% off on these time limited sales just like this. So go to your member, I don't want to call it a dashboard, but the member page on ATP.fm, and you should see your special discount code that you can enter in at Cotton Bureau to save 15%. And additionally, this will be available until Saturday, May 6th. I didn't do this exercise with you last time, so we'll do it this time. You are somewhere right now. Maybe you're walking, maybe you're driving, maybe you're just sitting around listening. Wherever you are, think to yourself, is it safe and appropriate for me to buy an ATP something right now? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. If it isn't, think about where you're going. If you're driving, think about where you're going to end up. Are you going to the office? Are you going to Whole Foods or Kroger or something? Wherever you end up, think about what you're going to do when you get there. What you're going to do is you're going to park your car or stop walking, whatever the case may be. And then you're going to go to atp.fm/store. And you're going to do that. And you're going to buy some merch or merchandise or stuff. Whatever, John, I'm sorry. You're going to buy some stuff. And you're going to do that before May 6th. You're going to do that today. So this way, I don't get to make fun of you for being that dum-dum that says to me, oh, is it still open? I forgot. Don't be that dum-dum. Don't be that person. atp.fm/store. John, anything you would like to add or correct at this juncture?
I would say we always try to do these sales for three episodes of the show. This is the middle episode. The next episode will be the very last one. And the problem with trying to say, oh, I've got one episode left, I'll just deal with that stuff then, is that you might not listen to next week's episode immediately. And the store is only live for a couple of days after the publication of next week's episode. I myself have almost forgotten to buy. All right. So one time I did forget to get stuff from the store. Of course, I had an inside line of the Cotton Bureau folks, and I said, hey, can you get me these items? And so that worked out for me, but you don't have that option. So I would say this is the time to do your ordering. Don't wait until next week, because it's only going to be a few days after the show is published. Do it now. Then you'll be able to have, you know, this week to decide what you're going to get. And I'll just remind everybody that if you don't care about shirts or don't want to pay for expensive shipping on a mug or whatever, but you still want to give the show money, membership, atp.fm/join. As for products, I want a few clarifying points on the Mac Pro Believe shirt. So last episode, I said it is the duty of the audience of this show to find out which of you actually got a WWDC ticket, because none of us did so far, and pick one of you to be the designated person to take one for the team being ATP listeners. Buy a Mac Pro Believe shirt of your choice, wear it to WWDC, and make sure Apple executives see it. And I'll be happy to say that many people from our audience said, hey, I got a ticket and I'm planning on going and I ordered a Believe shirt. So I think people will be there with the shirt on, hopefully very visible. Lots of people suggested that we buy this shirt and send it to various Apple executives, which seemed like a reasonable idea, but I'm not quite sure how to do that because I don't know what their mailing address is or whatever. But I figured, you know what? I'm going to give it a shot. So I ordered one shirt for John Ternus. And I had to decide what kind of shirt, you know, it's going to be a Mac Pro Believe shirt, right? I had to decide what he would like. So I looked at his most recent, I think it was his most recent video, like the event video. I forget what they were announcing. I just went in my archive of event videos, because of course I save all these videos. And I loaded it up and I scrubbed it until I saw John Ternus, and he was wearing black from head to toe. So I'm like, easy. Black and black Mac Pro Believe shirt, right? Because I assume they pick their own outfits for, you know, like no one's forcing him to wear all black. Other people were wearing different stuff, and he was black from head to toe. So I got a black Mac Pro Believe shirt, and I sent it to John Ternus and then the address of like the spaceship in Apple Park. Will that get to him? They probably have people screening their mail to make sure they're not getting sent, you know, anthrax or whatever. I hope it gets to him. But anyway, and the reason I sent it to him is because, like I said, from what I've heard, John Ternus actually does believe in the Mac Pro, and I wanted to send that to him as a form of support within the organization. Maybe he can just wear it to a meeting, you know, ask me about my shirt, right? Anyway, so I did that. And the other thing is, for the people who got a ticket and who are going to wear their shirt to WWDC, on the off chance that some Apple person actually asked them about it, like an executive or whatever, like I said last time, you can always just lie and say, oh, I really love the Mac Pro or whatever. Or you can tell the truth and say, I don't care about the Mac Pro, but, you know, some people in ATP do, and explain all that stuff. But there's a nuance I feel like I was leaving out there, because I thought of this when I was seeing something about it. I was like, interview with Tim Cook or something. Wasn't there some interview with him recently? Some article that was an interview with, I think he's in GQ recently. Anyway, I was reading an interview with Tim Cook, and I'm always thinking about, you know, we always have these conversations within the Apple community about what it's like to talk to Apple executives and how hard it is to get them off message. Like, they're all, you know, media trained, and the people who do talk to the public usually have some practice doing it. So you're not going to get them to say something, you know, off the cuff or whatever. The only person who could get away with that was Steve Jobs. Even the CEO, especially Tim Cook, doesn't do that. You know, he could do that. Who's going to yell at him other than, you know, I don't know, the board or the shareholders or whatever, but Steve Jobs didn't care about that. But anyway, everybody's so controlled, right? So there is the problem that, say, you're sitting there and, like, you know, some important Apple executive comes wandering over to you and says, hey, nice shirt. And you have this, like, this is it. I have my opportunity to talk about this podcast shirt that I wore with an Apple person. And I feel like what's going to end up happening is the interaction is going to go such that the Apple executive comes away thinking, isn't it nice? A customer likes our products. Right. That you're like, this is your favorite Apple product, and you wore a shirt talking about your favorite Apple product, and they'll come away thinking, it wasn't that so nice. Even our obscure products that most people don't care about, there's somebody who really cares about them. Oh, isn't that nice? And I feel like that's the wrong message. And it's really hard not to have that message go through, because if you're an Apple executive and you exchange pleasantries with a person who's wearing a shirt with a picture of your product on it, you're going to come away thinking, a fan of our products. But the actual message is, I don't know how you would convey this. It's basically impossible. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just acknowledging a problem here. So what we want them to say is, like, we care that this product exists, and we wish you treated it better. And it's very difficult when you meet an Apple executive to tell them something that you think they did poorly, because A, that's rude, right? So don't do that. And B, like, that's not the time or place to do that. And yet that's the whole point of the shirt. You don't have to say that. You can just
the time
wear
or place
it.
Is blog posts on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, or like whatever, right? Yeah, exactly. Write a blog post, or, you know, just, you know, write an article in a publication of your choice, or talk about it on a podcast. When you meet an Apple executive, they just want to hear the pleasantries. That's where the shirt comes in. The shirt should sort of speak on its own. I feel like you don't have to say anything about it. You can just wear it, and that will be the message, the silent message that you believe in the Mac Pro. And the silent message is, we don't think you believe Apple. We believe here in the audience. We wish you believed too. We wish you would update it more than every 5 years or so. We wish it wasn't always on life support. Like, those are all the things that you can't say that I'm hoping the shirt conveys. But I feel like if you actually had a chance to talk to one of them, that's not the right time to actually discuss that. But I don't know what you should say. Maybe you should just sit there silently and point to the shirt. I don't know. Anyway, I just wanted to acknowledge that and the difficulty of talking to Apple executives and my hope that my shirt does some talking for us.
Godspeed, John. Godspeed. Speaking of good luck to you, what's going on with your bug these days?
This is the time and place to talk about bugs. Mm-hmm. Yes. If you've got a podcast that you think people might hear about your... Anyway, this is the bug I talked about on 3 episodes so far, one of which it was cut out of. The last episode wasn't cut out, and I talked about it again. I've got some more progress on that bug. To refresh your memory, the bug is that when I drag a window in any application around, if it's near any other windows, it gets super slow and laggy and jumps around, right? And if you hide other windows so that they're not visible, or you move them away from the window you're moving, it chills out a little bit and doesn't do it as much. So it seems kind of like a bug in like the window snapping behavior that they added to macOS many years ago, where if one window comes close to another one, it snaps to its edge or whatever. And I couldn't figure out what this was. And at first I removed some third-party software and I'm like, it went away, I've solved it. But then it came back, right? And so I've been trying to track it down more, talking about it on Mastodon, you know, communicating with various people, back-channeling with Apple, because of course the feedback gets no response, right? Whatever. Since then, I've done some more stuff. I removed more third-party stuff, because last time I said I'd removed all third-party kernel extensions and all third-party system extensions as evidence from, Kexload and system extension control or something. What the hell is the command? System extension CTL is the one for system extensions, and Kextat, sorry. Kextstat space dash L. Both of those are showing zero, but there's more stuff. I thought I'm going on a rampage of removing third-party stuff, because the one tiny bit of back-channeled information I got was that lots of other people aren't having this problem. Some other people are, and I hear about it from a Mastodon, but lots of other people aren't. So I'm like, this has got to be something that I'm using, something that's specific to my setup. So I removed SteerMouse, which is my mouse acceleration thing. And I was like, oh, that's got to be it. I can't believe I didn't think of that, because it shows up as a preference pane, and now it's a settings, whatever. But it's not a kernel extension or a system extension, but it is a thing that has to do with the mouse. So I installed that. Then I was communicating on Mastodon with Steve Trout and Smith. I sent him some of my spin dumps that I had sent him the feedback, and he looked at them and he saw some Adobe stuff in there. And he's like, I can't tell if this is like just a symptom, because Adobe has like a crash reporter that catches crashes, and it was showing up in the spin dump. And so it's like, fine, wipe all Adobe stuff off the system, which was not easy. Let me tell you, I used the Adobe uninstaller to remove all Adobe stuff. There was still more Adobe stuff. And I know that because after I used the Adobe uninstaller and I rebooted, upon login, I got a crash report screen from an Adobe thing. I'm like, which luckily gave me the path to the Adobe thing. So in applications, utilities, there's a bunch of old Adobe stuff. Remove everything. Delete, delete. Adobe stuff is gone. Each time I did one of these things, remove SteerMouse, remove Adobe, I would reboot, to clean everything out. And the problem, what I had been telling people on Mastodon is like, the problem goes away when I reboot, but it comes back within minutes to hours, which is not a very precise thing, but that had been my experience. It always comes back, but it doesn't come back immediately. Sometimes it comes back in a few minutes. Sometimes it comes back in many hours. I didn't understand why, right? So after removing SteerMouse, I rebooted. I'm like, it's not coming back. I fixed it. But then it came back. After I wiped everything Adobe, I'm like, it's not coming back. I fixed it. But then it came back. Also, Typinator, which is my like text expander type thingy for abbreviation stuff, that recently had a Ventura update. So there was a for-pay update, but I'm like, I'm going to pay for it. I use it all the time. Fixes compatibility of Ventura. It said, yes, updated. I updated that. I didn't uninstall it because it has to do with typing, not mousing, but I updated that. And that didn't fix it either, right? But I also uploaded a new YouTube video, which we'll put in the show notes, that tries to better demonstrate the problem. Again, it's using stickies, but it doesn't matter. It could be any application. So I was using TextEdit as the windows that I'm going to be near, and I was using stickies as my window that I move around. You can look at the video. The main reason I put that up there is all my conversations in Mastodon, it's very difficult to tell if other people are actually having the same problem as me, because there are a lot of problems that manifest as my computer feels slow and laggy. And if you are dragging Windows around while your computer is slow and laggy, you'll be like, hey, I have that problem too. But I'm like, no, mine is a very specific problem. It has nothing to do with load on the system. It doesn't go away. Once it starts happening, it is like permanent and just like stays there forever, 100% reproducible for hours and days and weeks. Like it will not go away and it is always there. And it has a specific behavior with respect to other Windows that are near it. So that's why I made a new video. So you can take a look at that. And through discussing it with people, some people I eliminated and said, you're having a different problem than I am. Other people still said they looked at the video. They're like, yeah, that's exactly what's happening to me. And I would ask them questions. Are you running any Adobe stuff? Are you running Steer Mouse? Like, just looking for anything. Couldn't find anything. I did have a breakthrough, though, because I finally figured out after I reboot what makes the problem come back. Like, what, you know, every time, because I would always think I fix it. Like, this is it. I fix it this time. And I'd almost like declare I'd fix it. I'm asking, like, no, let me wait a day. Let me wait 2 days. And it would come back. I'm like, damn it. Didn't get rid of it. Right. And figured out what makes it come back. It's whenever there is more than one user logged in macOS.
Oh, man.
And that's why it was throwing me off, because I switched to my wife's account to mess with the photo library. Right. Because they don't have shared albums and stuff. Right. So I still have to hop over to her account, not as much as I used to, because I can do most of the stuff with shared library. But when I want to do like real organization into albums and stuff, or the face recognition, because it doesn't share face recognition either, I have to switch to her account. So it's basically like after I reboot, how long before I fast user switch into my wife's account? And as soon as I fast user switch into my wife's account, it starts happening in both of our accounts. If I switch back from her, it doesn't matter. Like, it's permanent, right? If I go back to her account and log out, it goes away. 100% reproducible. So I updated the feedback. I already updated the feedback. This video updated the feedback. I'm like, more info. I figured this out. And it's only when there's more than one user logged in. I tried a third account as well and tried, you know, like it's just when one account is logged in, everything is fine. When more than one account is logged in, the problem happens 100% of the time. So I added that to the feedback in case anyone at Apple is still looking at it. Once again, it's FB121221106, please. So, and I have so little third parties. Now I'm just removing everything. I haven't put anything back on. I haven't put Steer Mouse back on. I haven't put Adobe anything back on. Like, I'm removing everything that I could possibly remove. This is 100% reproducible. I've uploaded new spin dumps, uploaded new sysdiagnose. Does this explain the problem? No. I still have no good theories about what it is. I mean, Steve Trouton Smith had a lot of ideas about like the Adobe things, reading the window list and stuff like that. Like, that's why we thought it was Adobe, but that turned out not to be it. But like, when a second user is logged in, it happens. And here's the fun thing about it. If I log out, if I go to my wife's account and then I log out of her account and it switches back to mine, because that's the only one that's remaining to be logged in, it takes like a 3 count before it goes away. Because I'll log out of her account, switch back to mine, grab the stickies window, shake it around. It'll still be there for 1, 2, 3. Oh, no, it's fixed. So it's like logging out is like killing a bunch of processes or cleaning it. Like whatever it's doing behind the scenes to finish the log out of my wife's account eventually gets done and then it fixes it. So now that I know what the problem is, I no longer have to reboot to fix it. I just have to log out of my wife's account and everything will be fine. But man, what a weird bug. I wish if the Apple feedback system was better, I would have renamed the bug as, you know, window movement laggy when more than one account is logged in. Right. Because now I know what the thing is. But anyway, I hope someone at Apple looks at this, or I hope it cures itself in the next update or something. But I'm glad to have a workaround, but totally baffling. But I was excited for the breakthrough. I'll give you more updates as they come along. At this point, now that I know sort of not what's causing it, but how to trigger it and how to work around it, I'm a little bit less inclined to keep removing software from my system, but I probably will.
I'm sorry, John. I mean, that explains why I think a lot of people haven't seen it, because this is not scientific at all, but I can't think of anyone I know that runs multiple accounts on their Mac other than you. I'm sure I know people, but
I do. Well, this is not like my wife's Mac Studio. That's the one where people are likely to log into it. It was all four of us are logged in at all times on that thing. It's just like more communal, right? The only other, and all I have accounts for my whole family and my computer too, but the only one it's ever logged into is my wife. So it actually happens less frequently on my computer than the other computers in the house, but not, you know, it's still that's what was killing me about the thing is like, it always comes back. What's determining when it comes back? It's just whenever I switch over to that account. And I did ask the other people, as soon as I figured this out, anyone who said they had the same problem as me, I asked them, are you logged into more than one account? Some of them were, some of them weren't. So no progress in debugging this with other people.
That's why I'm hoping all these spin dumps I'm uploading to Apple will tell them something.
Godspeed, John.
Yeah, and before people ask, like, there are limits to the amount of inconvenience I'm willing to incur to deal with this, especially now that I have a workaround, because people are like, you should do safe boot. You should wipe your entire computer and make a fresh account. You, like, yeah, those are things I'm probably not going to do. Like, I understand how they would help narrow the problem down, but, like, I'm not going to destroy my computing life to fix this bug, especially now that I have a workaround. So I have done safe boot, by the way. I will actually try safe boot and then switching accounts, but I don't know if either one of you who done safe boot recently. It's super weird and everything's super janky. Have you tried that recently?
No, I don't even know how.
In a while.
Well, on your computers is different, but on the back on Intel computers, you hold down shift during boot. On your computers, you hold down the power button and there's something that's a safe boot. Like, it basically doesn't load anything. Like, it doesn't load the good graphics drivers, which is the most painful one. So, like, transparency doesn't work and the graphics are slow and janky and doesn't load any third party anything. Like, it's really, it's just, you know, it's safe mode, right? It's like, let's not load any of the software that might be causing crashes. And so it's not a tenable way to really run your computer. So that's why, you know, I should probably boot into safe mode again and then just try switching, doing fast user switching and see if that makes it come back. But beyond that, no, I'm not going to, like, you know, sign out of my Apple ID, delete all the user accounts or anything like that. Cause, like, you know, I'll just make sure I'm only logged into my wife's account briefly. Although it is kind of annoying that now when I switch over to her account, unless I'm going to log out of my account, which I'm not going to because I have too many windows open, I have to deal with the window dragon bug on her account. Because, like I said, when it starts happening, it happens on all logged in accounts, not just, you know, on mine.
Stinky. I'm sorry. But hopefully you'll have a fix in the next version of macOS, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I'll give it 5 years. Come on.
Yeah, right. Speaking of 5 years, long time follow up. I think it was Marco that was originally lamenting the lack of just a USB-C hub. There's a gazillion and seven, you know, traditional USB. What is it? A or B? I always forget. Traditional USB hubs, but there weren't really any USB-C hubs. And breaking news earlier today, Belkin has released a brand new USB-C hub that is four USB-C ports, one of which is power delivery, and so that basically leaves you three other ports, and apparently it's available right now. It is between $45 and $55 here in America. You can buy from Belkin directly or from Amazon. I don't personally have a need for this. I'm still rocking my CalDigit TS4, which I really, really like, but hey, Marco, this is the answer to all your problems, right?
I hope. I mean, the good thing is, look, I'm glad this finally exists. Unfortunately, I don't need it anymore, but I will. Like, currently, I don't need it because Apple has added more ports to the computers, and you know, generally speaking, that has dramatically lightened the load on my dongle needs. But fortunately, this now exists. I hope it's good. Time will tell. There are a bunch of like kind of USB-C hubs that have come out on the market. Most of them, though, are, you know, similar to the various, you know, Thunderbolt thingies. Most of them are like really high power things that have their own giant power bricks and, you know, all that stuff. It's not really like a hub that as we would think of it. And on most of them, because the bandwidth needs are so high on USB-C, the number of ports is fairly low and the cost per port is fairly high on many of them. So, you know, it's been tough to get into this world. It's like, if you want to convert everything over to USB-C, and again, there's many other reasons why it's been tough that we've gone over, but if you want to convert everything over to USB-C, cables and everything, it has been tough because products like this didn't really exist. So now it exists, and I hope it's good, and I hope more continue to come out. And, you know, and I hope we, you know, now and for many years, you've been able to get like a 10-port USB-A hub that had USB 3 speeds on many of those ports, and wasn't that expensive and didn't have a giant power brick. So I hope we get something like that for USB-C because we don't need like 18 high speed 10 gigabit per second ports. We need maybe two or three of those and then a whole bunch of ports that mostly provide power and low speed data. So I hope we get to that world soon with USB-C, but this is an important step to get there. I'm really glad we have these.
Yep. I mean, again, I don't have a need for this, like you were saying, but I'm pleased that this is a thing, just like you said. All right, John, your Google Authenticator woes have been solved, allegedly. The Google Authenticator now will sync your 2FA codes if you wanted to, which is super exciting.
Yeah, would have liked this before I had to spend 3.5 hours sitting in the Apple Store. to update my, I was getting my phone replaced because of the camera. Anyway, better late than never. It does syncing now. I have, since dealing with that, I have actually migrated all of my two-factor stuff into iCloud Keychain, which was a little bit tedious, but I got it done. But now, being typical of me, I'm maintaining it in both places, right?
Of course.
Kind of like how I use a Chrome and Safari all day long, and Chrome doesn't integrate with iCloud Keychain. But the other thing, I thought it did.
I thought they have like an extension for it or something.
Yeah, for Windows.
Oh, whoopsie doopsies.
It's really dumb. Yeah. I mean, you can always just go and copy and paste it, but that gets to why I'm still running Google Authenticator, right? Everything's in iCloud Keychain, and I maintain it in there, like, as, you know, sort of my main place. But even with the cool shortcut from Ricky Mondello that lets you jump into the passwords, I was going to say preference pane, the password setting thing in iOS, which is, it's not buried, it's the second level thing, but you can put that on your home screen and jump right to it. Then you're faced with all of your passwords. And then you have to use the search field to search for the domain you're interested in, find the one and tap into it, and then get to the two-factor thing and tap it to copy and so on and so forth. Whereas in Google Authenticator, the only thing that's in there are two-factor codes. There's no passwords, no nothing else. So even though it may be a screen or two, it's huge font. It's on the top level. You launch the app, you can see all your stuff there, and you just tap the one that you want. It's much faster for me to get my two-factor code from Google Authenticator than it is to get it from iCloud Keychain. Now, if you use Safari, you never need to do either one of those things because it's integrated into the browser and it just fills it in for you. Like, that's the point of it. But Chrome does not integrate with iCloud Keychain on Apple devices. So if you are using Chrome and you are faced with a two-factor text box, you can't just click in it and autofill from iCloud Keychain because it doesn't do that integration. It could. The APIs exist for it. It just doesn't because Google, whatever. So I still maintain both of them. But I'm glad it has syncing because that'll save me a lot of headaches next time I upgrade my devices. Thing to know about the syncing is it is not end-to-end encrypted. iCloud Keychain is end-to-end encrypted, which means that Apple can't see anything in my iCloud Keychain, right? That's the point of end-to-end encryption. Apple does not have the keys to it. It's only on all of my devices. Google intentionally chose not to do that. You can see an explanation on this Twitter thread that we'll put in the show notes from, I'm assuming it's someone from Google. I actually didn't check. Christian Brand, let's see. Yes, well, the URL on his thing says Google. Yeah, someone at Google explains they intentionally didn't do this just because it gives Google the ability to save people's bacon if they screw up real bad, right? That's their explanation. And, you know, that is a trade-off, but I just want people to know, don't enable this syncing if you care about Google, the company, having access to your two-factor codes. Again, this is not for passwords. This is just for two-factor authentication code things.
All right, tell me about Duncan Wilcox's hi, Future Marco.
Hey.
I kept seeing the COX there, and it ain't there. All right, let me try that again. All right, tell me about Duncan Wilcox's woes with regard to duplicates in Apple Photos.
This is the shared library feature that we've talked about in Apple Photos. Apple Photos had duplicate detection for a while, but not for shared libraries. So recently they added it for shared libraries, and I've been working through that with my giant collection. Last episode, I said that I had been informed that duplicate detection is not as smart as you might think it is. So I backed up all of the duplicates that duplicate detection found, like it puts them in recently deleted or whatever, and I just backed them all up and shoved them in an archive somewhere so that if it did screw up something, I have that thing there to save my bacon, you know, so that way I don't have to, you know, visually vet every single duplicate that resolved because it literally resolved 30,000 of them for me. So I'm just going to back them up and forget about it. Here's a new twist. Duncan says, regarding Apple Photo duplicates, check your photos projects, especially if you made some recently with Motif or similar. And by projects, he means like the little photo books that you can make or whatever. They're in the sidebar in Apple Photos on the Mac. You see all the list of all your products if you've made a calendar or a printed book or whatever. So Duncan says, I think mine are missing photos like Swiss cheese following the deleting of many duplicates. I have about 90,000 photos. And it continues, merge duplicates does figure out if a photo is in an album and preserve that relationship. For example, a low-res version of a photo in an album, the low-res version is deleted from the library, but the higher-res version is now in the album. So Apple Photos itself does the right thing. Like, when it merges duplicates, you don't have to worry about, oh, the one it threw out is the one that was in my album, and now it's missing from my album. No, it takes whatever one it picks to be the winner in the duplicate fight, that one takes the place of where all the other ones that got chucked away ended up being. But for Photos projects, that doesn't always happen. So I went and looked because I have tons of photo books. I make a photo book at least once a year, sometimes more, for my Long Island vacation and maybe other vacations. And I looked at those books, and sure enough, many photos were missing. I would click on the project, and I got a little dialog box that would say, some photos are missing. Some photos have been modified, moved, or deleted outside of the application or removed from some sections of this project. And the example that I have here, pages 1, 5, 6, 9, 10, 12, 14. I'm not going to read all the numbers. A lot of pages are missing covers. Okay. And I was like, oh, that's not great. So why do I care if photos are suddenly missing from my photo book projects? I've already printed the books. They're sitting on my shelf, right? The whole reason I keep these products around is that someday those books get destroyed. My house burns down in a fire. There's a flood, you know, whatever. Whatever happens to those books. I did spend a lot of time making those books, which means picking the photographs that are going to be in the books, picking how those photos are going to be arranged on the page, how they're going to be cropped, picking the cover image, picking the back, if there's any text. Like, I spent time making that. I want that effort to be preserved. And I had been doing that by just keeping the photo book products. So, hey, if I lose a book or get the house burns down, I can restore my backups in my new house and just reprint all those books at massive expense. But still, I would have the ability to do it. So that's why I'm saving those projects. And now they're missing a bunch of photos. So I investigated. I looked at one of the books, and these are all done with, at this point, third-party software. I use the Mimeo Photos extension. Motif is another one that does something similar. Both of those companies, I think, were involved in printing the books when Apple did it. So I picked a book. I picked my most recent photo book that was missing photos from tons of pages. I went to the first page where it said it was missing photos, and sure enough, where there should have been a photo, there was just the gray, like, you know, photo goes here, and it wanted me to select a photo. But the thing is, all the photos that it said were missing, they were still in the projects, because when I opened up the little photo sidebar and to pick a photo to go in that spot, the photo that should be in that spot was in the sidebar. So I think what's happening is Apple Photos is doing the right thing, but this third-party software is confused about the fact that previously, the photo with some identifier, internal identifier, was on that page, and Apple Photos replaced it with the one that it picked out of the merge duplicate. And the sidebar, you know, the project showing which photos to pick from, that understood that, but the page did not understand it. And so what I had to do was, for my most recent few books, and I'll explain why in a second, I didn't have to do all of them. I had the paper book in front of me, found the missing photo, looked at the paper book and said, okay, it should be this photo and it should be cropped in this way. And I just reselected it from the sidebar, put it in there, and repaired the most recent three books. And the reason I only had to repair the most recent three books is because the whole reason I'm doing this is sort of preserve the work that I have done, so I know which photos are on which page and how they're arranged and all that. But there's a better way to do that. The better way to do that is to make a digital version of the book. And Apple's photo books had a way to do this, and so do all these so does Mimeo, the third-party extension that I use. You can export your book as a PDF. It doesn't really look like a book anymore, but it does show every single page in the print layout. And I had exported the PDFs dutifully for every photo book that I have ever done over the many years, except for the past 3 years when apparently I forgot all about it. So I repaired the last 3 years of photo books. I exported them as PDF. You used to be able to export as two kinds of PDF. One was called like a regular PDF for viewing, and the other was called a quote-unquote production PDF, which presumably you could give to the printer and they could print again. But anyway, there's only one choice now in Mimeo, which is export as PDF, and so I did that. So now I have backups of all my books, like their layouts, their actual print-style layouts for every single page of all of my books in a digital form, which of course is nicely backed up. And now I don't feel the need to go back through every single one of my photo books and repair the missing photos, which are surely there, by the way. And there is some hope that these third-party extensions realize that this is going on and figure out how to, swap in the winner of the duplicate merge process into the place where the old one was. But I didn't want to wait around for that. So hopefully, in what is hopefully the final wrinkle in the shared library duplicate thing, check your projects. If you care about this at all, check your projects. And if you have to, you can repair them without too much work, as long as you have the print one to refer to. And I would suggest that if you do care about the layout, export to PDF, because then all your work will be preserved. In the worst case scenario, you could recreate the book from scratch by looking at the PDF.
All right, we have yet more feedback with regard to receivers and such. Stephen Brandon writes, this is kind of a lot, but we did our best. And by that, I mean, John did his best to pare it down. With regard to Atmos and DTSX on an Apple TV, although the listener on a past episode said that they had an HTA9 system, that was not actually the source of the problem they were talking about. The issue is that the Apple TV will not even pass through the Atmos or DTSX metadata on anything other than EAC3. The Apple TV will not let apps bitstream anything other than a few formats to a receiver or anything else, and instead generally re-encodes audio data as PCM before sending it to the receiver. This is fine for regular surround audio, as the conversion to PCM is lossless, but it also means you lose out on the Atmos type metadata, including height data, etc. This might seem like it would make it impossible to pass along the height and other Atmos type metadata, but there is a solution. Apple does use a technology called Dolby MAT to embed this data into PCM audio for some audio, mostly audio coming from its own apps and some streaming apps that support Atmos, which apparently modern receivers can understand. But Apple doesn't seem to allow third-party app makers to access this option. The Infuse post linked to last week does an even better job explaining all this. With every tvOS release, I always hope that we'll find out that Apple has opened this up to the makers of apps like Plex and Infuse. All of this is to say that those of us with high-end receivers, John, still have the problem with Apple TV of not being able to take full advantage of the audio on our ripped Blu-ray collections. It is not a problem isolated to the HTA9. Sad trombone.
Yeah, so obviously I don't have height channels, but the other thing is I have a Blu-ray player. Like, I don't have ripped Blu-rays. Like, so there's a lot of people with Synologies and ripped Blu-rays writing in feel this, but that's why I'm saying use NVIDIA Shield. It's the only thing that does this, right? There's lots of other possible solutions. It's kind of disappointing that the Apple TV literally won't even pass it through. That seems like something they could hopefully fix with a software update. But yeah, like, that's why, you know, part of the having the receiver is then you can hook all sorts of stuff up to it, like an actual Blu-ray player, and then your Apple TV is entirely out of the mix. Jonathan LaCour had a few other suggestions here. He says, this and other limitations led me to invest in a Zedoo Z9X box. I have no idea what that is. He says, it's Android, clunky, and weird. Sounds like something Marco might be interested in. but it supports literally everything. That said, you are correct that most people probably shouldn't care. If you don't have height channels, it's irrelevant. If you don't have high quality speakers, it's irrelevant. And most critically, if you consume content exclusively through streaming, it literally doesn't matter. But of course, he says, those of us who have invested in height channels and Synologies filled with Blu-ray rips are the only people who should care. So some people should care. And honestly, Apple should get on this. Like, fine, you can't deal with it. At least pass it through. It's kind of disappointing they don't do that. But just FYI.
All right, moving on. There was some breaking news that happened, I think, as we were recording last week, that I don't know if we'll have too much to say about this famous last words, but I wanted to call it to our attention, to your attention. Reddit has decided to start charging for API access. And this is particularly relevant to me because if you recall from a couple episodes ago when we were talking about FlukeUp, as Aaron continues to make fun of me for. as we were talking about that, I was saying, you know, even though there doesn't appear to be very much, if any, charge for using the movie database's API right now, you never know what'll happen, right? And so that's exactly what's going on with Reddit. My limited understanding is that pretty much all of the API was free. And it sounds like at first they kind of took the Twitter or one of the 17 iterations of Twitter's approach in that they said, okay, well, bots will remain free. But other things like full-featured apps like Apollo, which is my preferred app for looking at Reddit, the API access for Apollo will not be free. And additionally, sexually explicit material will not be available via the API at all. That seems to be the TLDR from what I can gather. So a quote from their announcement, which we will link in the show notes, we are introducing a premium access point for third parties who require additional capabilities, higher use limits, and broader usage rights. Our data API will still be open for appropriate use cases and accessible via our developer platform. So, of course, Christian, who writes Apollo, was pooping his pants when this all went down and apparently had a couple of phone calls with Reddit. And he put together a really, really, really good post on Reddit, of course, about what this really seems to mean based on his conversations with Reddit. And so, quoting Christian, to this end, Reddit is moving to a paid API model for apps. The goal is not to make this inherently a big profit center, but to cover both the cost of usage as well as the opportunity costs of users not using the official app, lost ad views, etc. The API cost will be usage-based, not a flat fee, and will not require Reddit Premium, which is, I believe, Reddit's paid thing, for users to use it, nor will it have ads in the feed. The goal is to be reasonable with pricing, not prohibitively expensive. And so I thought this was all interesting given what I'm going through. Also, it's worth noting that Imgur, I guess that's what it's how it's pronounced, has, I guess, recently banned sexually explicit uploads. So there's apparently a big kerfuffle about that. I don't personally care about that at all, but it's kind of tangentially related. So worth noting. But yeah, this is why pricing for anything we are not controlling the API is tough, right? You know, because you never know what the future will bring. And you don't want to have to renege on a lifetime unlock that was like just a bit more than a monthly fee or something like that. Like, obviously, you probably wouldn't price a lifetime unlock that cheaply. But you see what I'm saying, that, you know, if you never know what the future will bring, and reneging on what you already had going is a real bad look. Even if it's not really your fault, it's just not a good look. And so I don't know. I don't know if either of you have anything to note on this. If not, we can just move right along. But it was an interesting and relevant thing for me anyway, given what I'm working on right now.
Is Apollo subscription or pay once?
I thought there might be a free version. You know, I honestly don't recall. I'm pretty sure I did a fairly expensive lifetime unlock. It was something between $50 and $100. And I'm pretty sure that's what I had done. And I believe before that it was like a yearly subscription. I don't know if there's a free version, to be honest with you. I really don't recall.
I mean, the escape hatch for things like this, it's not great, and you know, customers hate it, and developers so I don't like to do it, but you just, you know, you make Apollo 2 and that one is subscription only, right? So
that's fair.
With all these terrible options that we're kind of accustomed to as both customers and developers on the App Store, like, we can't do upgrade pricing, we can't do this, we can't do that, but there's, you know, the way to do it is you just, well, this product is dead now. Sorry, here's version 2 of the product, which would have just been the next update to this one, but can't be for reasons related to how the business of the App Store works. So, and then everyone yells at you and they give you the 1-star reviews. And it's just like, it's a very sort of very unhealthy dynamic, I feel like, in a lot of ways between customers and developers, because in many cases, developers would like to do things that customers would like better. Like, we would, you know, upgrade pricing, for example, or like somehow giving lower prices to people who recently bought a thing. Like, you know, I make a new version of a thing and there's an upgrade price, but if you bought the old one recently, you get the upgrade for free. Like, all the things that Mac developers would do before the App Store, you know, where you have the flexibility to be nicer to your customers. And the App Store does more of those things than it used to, but still not nearly as many as good Apple developers used to do back in the days before they were constrained. And this is an example. Hey, our app used to be like you could do a one-time unlock, but that was when the API was free. Now the API is not free anymore. And we're eventually going to go into the red on all those users because their lifetime unlock is going to run out, essentially. And then we'll be losing money every time they use our application. And that's not tenable. So how do we deal with that? You'd like to just be able to say to those people, you know, after your money runs out, start paying the monthly thing or whatever, or it'll stop working. Or like, you could do something that is better than, hey, the app you're using is dead. Now here's Apollo 2. And you've never purchased anything in Apollo 2, so you're starting from zero. And that will make people feel bad because they're like, I bought a lifetime unlock. And you're like, well, you did get a lifetime unlock for Apollo 1. It's it's such a stupid situation that nobody likes, and it just makes everybody upset. Part of it, obviously, is what you're talking about, Casey, which is like, well, isn't the root problem here that you sold an application with a flat rate unlock and you didn't control the API and you just assumed it would be free forever? Yeah, that is kind of the root problem here. But a lot of things work like that because, you know, free APIs often exist. I don't know, quite know why Reddit had it. Maybe they're just, you know, management was not paying too much attention, but a lot of times it's like companies that are in a growth phase, right? And they're VC funded and they just need to get big real fast. And so, yeah, everything's free. The accounts are free. Using it is free. The API is free, 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 because we need to get users, eyeballs, or whatever you want to call them, whatever the lingo is, because we need to, you know, get a big enough growth numbers to get our next round of funding. But then eventually, like, the check comes due. Either you actually did get big and it's time to start turning on the money tap, see also Netflix, Amazon, and many other big companies, or you didn't get big and now the company's going down the tubes and they need to make money. I don't think either one of those applies to Reddit. They've been around for a long time. They're not in their growth phase. They already did grow pretty big, but I think they have management now that's saying, you know, running this API is actually costing us a lot of money. Let's see if we can get some return on that investment. And they're doing it in so it seems like a fairly thoughtful way to try to get money from people who can afford to pay it while not destroying the value of their service, you know, by allowing bots and stuff like that. Basically the opposite of whatever Twitter's doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look at this and you can see this is probably what Twitter should have done. Like, Twitter probably should have taken an approach like this.
Should be run by people with a clue. Yeah, that would be really good.
Yeah. I mean, people who care and are competent. But, you know, it when you look at the age that Reddit came up in, you know, as John was saying, like, it kind of started as, you know, it was a very nerdy thing and launched by very nerdy people during a very nerdy time of the internet. You know, this is Reddit's been around for quite some time. And when it was coming up, that was the era of like the web 2.0, everything has an API, like that kind of age. And as we talked about before with Twitter, like at some point people realize, you know, companies realize, like, why are we giving away value? And why are we, in many cases, more importantly, why are we giving up control? So Reddit came right out and said, like, part of their reason for this was that people who use third-party apps like Apollo aren't necessarily seeing Reddit's ads or aren't in some other way, like, benefiting whatever Reddit's newest business direction or revenue opportunity might be, because they're not using the Reddit official apps or website. And so obviously many companies would look at that and have looked at that situation and would say, well, we don't want to give up any control. We don't want to give up control of our product or our monetization strategies or whatever. So we're just going to not have a public API or shut down the public API. That's how Overcast is. Overcast does not offer an API for lots of reasons, including that. And so you can see why companies would get there. But it is difficult when you have a product like Twitter, where the API is such a key part of what makes it useful to a lot of people. And so you have to have a bit of a different calculus there to do it right and to support the things that cause your service to have value to a lot of people.
Or like Reddit, where you have years and years of people using an API. Like, it's not as big a deal as Twitter, whereas like the third party clients were such a big part of its growth. But like, you've got a legacy of people using applications like Apollo. Some of your best Reddit users probably use Apollo. So making the decision to say no more third party clients would be the wrong move. But at the same token, you can't like lose money on those people.
Right, exactly. And, you know, in the case of Twitter, I think they called it wrong. You know, Twitter saw a problem, which is a real problem, which is we have these third-party apps that are making people not use our first-party apps and are not showing ads and are eating into the control of our product experience. And we don't control them. They're run by, you know, other random people who we don't control. And so we have limited ways to deal with this. And so we're just going to shut it down. And that, you know, that's kind of a, you know, a brute force approach that, you know, I don't think was the right move for them for lots of reasons. I think they destroyed a lot of value for both them and other people, but especially, I mean, just for Twitter itself, they destroyed a lot of value of Twitter by doing that. And I think they lost more people than they expected to lose. And I think the other API restrictions they're putting in place, like not being able to run simple bot accounts that people actually use for various useful, legitimate purposes without paying like $100 a month, that is, I think, destroying lots of value of Twitter. And so, and will ultimately, I think, serve them poorly with these decisions among many.
And to be clear, like that was the stuff we're talking about here is most recently what Elon did. But prior to that, many, many years prior, Twitter tried to thread this needle by having the same realization that, oh, third-party clients, they've been such an important part of Twitter, but we can't get rid of them entirely because our best users use them. So what can we do? And they basically tried to sunset essentially third-party clients, where they sort of said, if you have an existing third-party client and you have a lot of customers, we'll let you have, I don't remember what the calculus was. It was like, say you've got, you know, 100,000 customers. You can have 100,000 more, but then that's it, right? And they had this whole token-based system where every customer you got, you were using up one of your tokens. And I don't remember, it was like you got to double your customer base or triple it or whatever the calculus was. They basically said, no more third-party clients, but anyone who already exists, you can keep running your business up to a limit. And the limit was pretty big. That's why for years and years after they did that, I was still using Twitterific, which was, you know, I think the original third-party Twitter client that I used for the entire history of Twitter until it went down tubes. That's how they tried to thread the needle. And at that time, everyone was pissed off at it then. That's why all my Mastodon accounts are all from 2017, or app.net or whatever. Like, we went to app.net, yeah, we went to Mastodon, right? Because we were annoyed by the way they tried to thread that needle. It was like, don't you realize how important third-party clients are? And that was the kinder, gentler way to try to do it, is say, we're not just going to kill all third-party clients. We're not going to just remove the free API, but we do want to take back control of the experience And basically, we don't want there to be any more clients. Just the existing ones can continue to have a business. And then the Elon Musk way to do it is just to turn everything off and shoot yourself in the foot over and over and over again. So, but the Reddit way, I feel like, is even better than what Twitter did, because it's like, look, all those third-party clients, they're important to our business, and we can literally make money from them. Not a huge amount of money, but hopefully enough to pay for, to offset the cost. So we won't lose money on them, and we will keep the people, the users of Apollo, who are in theory very avid, you know, good customers for Reddit in terms of they use the product a lot. We can get money from them through third-party clients by charging for an API, and maybe that will cover costs. We'll see how their plan goes for them, but it definitely seems nicer than either one of the, certainly nicer than the current Twitter plan, but also nicer than the whatever year that was, 2017-ish plan from Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would criticize about this, so Reddit's plan, so far, the big thing, we don't know the pricing yet, but they have said that the way it will be structured, at least in their current idea of this, the way it will be structured is the users won't pay, the app developers will pay. And I think that's backwards. Ideally, I always thought this is what Twitter should do. Ideally, services like this that want to have an API that without losing money on it, make the user accounts pay the service for API access with those accounts. So, for instance, if Twitter is going to have their monthly premium plan, whatever, you know, Twitter Blue, whatever it would be, charge users a few bucks a month for whatever that account level is. And then you can use that account level with any app using the API. And then the app developers are never financially involved directly with the company.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know what you're going for that. It seems better from a user's perspective. But I think allowing the app developers to essentially skim off the top and be like in the middle there is important, because here's the deal. It still costs money to maintain and develop Apollo. And so, good third-party applications may still want to charge a subscription, but it's so much harder for them to do that. So I have to pay for a subscription for the API to Reddit, and I have to pay for a subscription to Apollo. If you just combine those two together and added a profit margin for Apollo, even though it would be more total expense, you'd just feel like, oh, I'm subscribing to Apollo. And basically, you know, your money is passing through the developers of Apollo, and they take a cut, and then the rest of it goes to pay for the API, kind of like weather applications. We don't pay for, you know, whatever the weather API is, AccuWeather API. Individual customers don't sign up with AccuWeather to get an API and then shop for clients. We all just buy a weather app. We pay for a subscription to the weather app. The weather app takes a cut of that and then passes the rest of the API thing. I guess it hasn't been tried the way you're describing. So it could work kind of like it worked like that with RSS. We'd pay for Feedbin or Feedly, right? And then we'd use a newsreader on top of that. So I think it can work. I just wonder if in this case it would be too much subscription. But, we'll see. Like, it just from reading the subscription, it doesn't seem unreasonable, but I don't know I kind of know what Reddit users are like. But anyway, I don't know how this is going to turn out, because every customer base is different. And I'm going to say that the customer base for Reddit API usage is probably not like the general public.
Oh, well. Yeah,
I would agree with that. Now, and I think the other advantage of doing it this way is that Reddit is likely to come out looking like a good guy, because unless you're deeply in tune as to what's going on and the machinations of what's happening behind the scenes, what it looks like is that Christian's going to have to start charging more. I'm assuming, I don't know this, but Christian's going to have to start charging more, or just, kill the free version of Apollo. And from a user's perspective, unless you're really plugged in, that just means Christian's a big jerk. Well, it's obviously not true, but that's what it seems like, right? Whereas if Christian instead says, oh, well, you have to open a direct relationship with Reddit and give me, access and blah, 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 then Reddit's the jerk, because you have to go and talk to mom and dad about it. But the way it works now, the way Reddit wants it to be, is that, oh, Christian's a big jerk. He's the one that needs extra money. It's not us. Well, really it is, but don't look behind the curtain. It's Christian that's the problem. And so from a business perspective, it's a win-win, right? Because they get more money and they don't have to be the bad person. And so I totally understand why they're doing it. But again, if they're really doing this just to recoup the expense and a little bit of the opportunity cost, if that really is true, this may not be bad at all. But, time will tell. All right. Hi, Future Marco. Still good to continue on, I assume, because we're only an hour.
Yeah, 17. We're at 1:13. So, yeah, we're pretty good.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. Goodbye, Future Marco.
Bye.
So we had an Ask ATP from probably a while ago, knowing us, that we decided to promote to a full-on topic, because I thought this would be kind of fun for the old dudes here to reminisce a little bit. So Torb wrote that they had watched the Verge video about the Lisa, which is only about 10 minutes long. It's pretty good.
Delightful.
Where they mentioned, yeah, it's very good. That they mentioned offhand that the original Mac didn't have multitasking! Exclamation point. I just really wondered what would that have been like. I think John would know. And then I thought I'd love to hear all of you talk about how computers you used when growing up were different and how they affected your usage patterns. So I have a little tour of like seminal moments of my childhood with regard to computing, but perhaps we should start by John answering the question. So how did multitasking work on the original Macintosh, John?
Yeah, I guess, you know, as we get older, and young people don't realize exactly how primitive things were. I often think, I've heard this from other people my age. I often think that I'm very lucky to have been born when I was in terms of technology. And I think we all kind of were, because we got to see both sides of the big internet divide. What was life like before the internet was pervasive, and what was life like after? And we were there for that transition. So we have those two experiences. We did have a time in our life without the internet, and we know what that was like. And that's, you know, kids born today never have that time, right? And you know, that was important for me. I also got to see the personal computer revolution. Like, I existed at a time when personal computers were not a thing, and then they became a thing, and I was there for that happening. Many things like that. I think about the dawn of the web. I was there for that. Like, makes us all old fogies, but it is very interesting. It's kind of like people who are like born during the Industrial Revolution or the advent of cars. Like, there's lots of very important technological inflection points in history, and we got to live through some really important ones. That does mean I have the perspective of, you know, what things were like before, like even like video games, like going from literal Pong, right, to what we have today is a leap that is, you know, it's going to be a while before the next leap like that happens. Maybe it's AR/VR, but honestly, I think it's going to have to be something past that with some kind of neural interface to have the same impact as going from Pong to today's games. So for the Apple platforms in particular, I mean, this applies to all personal computers, but the Apple platforms in particular, remember the Lisa was like 10 grand in 1983 money or something. Yeah. It was not an affordable computer. It costs as much as a car, more than a car, right? That's why the Mac succeeded. One of the reasons why the Mac succeeded and the Lisa didn't. It was just too darn expensive. But it was also much more powerful. Like, all that money was going to making a more powerful computer. The Mac, even though the Mac was also expensive, it was, you know, $2,400 in 1984 money. It was a quarter of the price of the Lisa, right? And so while the Lisa had some rudimentary form of multitasking, the Mac absolutely did not. Remember, the original Macintosh had 128 kilobytes of RAM, kilobytes. And that's like, oh, the Commodore 64, VIC-20, they had even less. This thing ran a full GUI, a full complete GUI, right? And 128 kilobytes of RAM. There wasn't much room for anything like, and it got around it by using lots of ROM. One of the things you would learn about back in the early days of the personal computer is very important. In your first course where you learned about computers, you learn this is the keyboard, this is the monitor. There were no mice because they didn't know about them. Computer, monitor, and like literally the next thing you would learn is the difference between RAM and ROM, which is a distinction that has not really been important in anyone's life, but boy, they wanted you to know it. Anyway, the Mac had a bunch of ROM, and that saved a bunch of memory, because that stuff could be in read-only memory. It was always accessible, and you didn't need to waste RAM on it. Anyway.
But so just really quickly, to put things in perspective. So you said 128 kilobytes. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Of RAM. So the icon for my forthcoming app is 125 kilobytes. Just the icon. The entirety of the original
is
Macintosh.
Is that compressed? I think it's compressed.
Well, yeah, probably. It's a JPEG. But never, the point is just that.
Your icon's not a JPEG, please.
It is absolutely, it doesn't matter. Just concentrate here.
Wait, why is it a JPEG?
It's not a JPEG.
Please don't
make
it
a JPEG.
Oh,
it's
God,
not. It's absolutely not a JPEG.
I'm looking in the asset catalog in the file system. It's a JPEG in the file system. It doesn't freaking matter.
You are not using a JPEG.
Someone,
Jesus Christ.
Please.
Concentrate.
Why don't you concentrate, get a screenshot into a Word document?
Get a PNG, please, for your icon.
I will bother Jelly, who was kind enough to do this and is probably listening to this mortified, because I bet you he sent me a ping and then somehow it ended up a JPEG. I don't even know how.
Yeah,
but
you need to
concentrate. Concentrate, John.
All right. But anyway, well, here's the thing about bitmaps. The uncompressed version of the bitmap of your thing, add it up. Add up the RGB values. The uncompressed size of that is way bigger than 128 kilobytes.
Exactly. And I'm not running a full operating system in space. I'm just storing a very, very large icon.
Yeah. If you just want to, store one icon asset, that's it. All your RAM is gone. Right. Yeah. So the way this manifested in multitasking is a couple different ways. So like I did have a VIC-20 before this, which had 20 kilobytes of RAM. It's even less, but it did nothing. It was attached to your television set. It had a keyboard. It had no mouse. It had no GUI. It was a command line or end basic, like very simple stuff, right? But this was a full-fledged GUI, right? And it had, the original Macintosh had one floppy drive built into the computer. I didn't have an external one. So you got one 400K floppy drive. That's all your data, right? And what you'd do is you'd stick in a floppy disk. It would boot. You turn the computer on, stick in a floppy disk, because if you turn the computer on, it would just have a flashing question mark icon. Then you stick in a floppy disk and it boots, right? That floppy disk has the operating system on it.
Well, I feel like you need to slow down here again. There was no hard drive, right? Like,
oh, yeah, no hard drive.
It did not exist. There was no storage. Well,
the Lisa had a hard drive.
That's true. But on the original Mac, there was nowhere to put your stuff except the floppy disk drive.
I mean, there's all personal computers. I mean, Commodore 64 didn't have a hard drive. The VIC-20 didn't have a hard drive. The Apple II didn't have a hard drive.
No, yeah. If you're less than a million years old like we are, this is probably not really making any sense.
So you're booting and running from this floppy drive, right? So the floppy drive had the operating system on it. You could also wedge onto that floppy disk. You could also put like one application. So you could put like maybe Mac Paint on there, right? So then you could boot from the operating system on the floppy drive, and then you'd see the operating system and you'd see Mac Paint. You double click Mac Paint, and when you double click Mac Paint, everything goes away and just Mac Paint is running, right? And if you save the document in Mac Paint, you could save that to the floppy disk drive too, but not too many documents, because if you save too many documents up, now you've filled your floppy drive. Because remember, the floppy disk, the 400K floppy disk has the OS, the one application you're using, and all the files you're saving from that application, right?
And like, how big was the OS? Like how much free space would you tend to have on a floppy drive?
I think the OS was maybe half. I mean, I should fire up Mini VMac and check what it is. But like, it seemed like there was enough room. You could have more than one application on there. Like, it didn't seem like it was taking up more than half. But maybe it was. Maybe it was like 300K. I can look it up. But it was small. But so here's the workaround for this, right? Eventually, if you're a power user like me, you'd be like, okay, but I've got a lot. I've got Mac Paint. I've got Mac Write. I've got all my school papers. It would be better. I have this box of floppy disks here. What I would want is I can have like an operating system disk and maybe, whatever, but I would also like to have like a data disk or maybe a disk that just has Mac Write and all my papers on it, right? Remember, Mac Write came on a floppy disk from Apple that said Mac Write, it was printed or whatever. But you'd also want to have like, well, what about all these other floppy disks? I'll just store my papers on those. So the way it would work is you would boot from your startup disk or whatever. Then you would eject that floppy disk. And what would happen, so the floppy disk icons would appear on the desktop. I think that's not even the default on macOS anymore. But the floppy disk icon would appear on the desktop. And when you ejected it, you'd see like a grayed out, not gray because it was a black and white screen, but a black and white dithered grayed out icon. We would call it a ghost icon of the floppy disk that you just ejected, right? It would still be visible there. You could see it, but it was a ghost of its former self, right? Then you would stick in your other floppy disk, the one that has, a different application, Mac Draw or something on it, right? Or it has your files on it or something. You'd stick that one in and say, okay, here's my school paper. And I double click my school paper. Okay. Double clicking the school paper would launch Mac Write, but Mac Write was back on the other disk. So what it would do is it would eject your disk and say, please put in the system disk that had Mac Write on it. And you put in the system disk and it would grind, grind, grind. And then it would eject it. And it would say, please put in the disk that had a document. And you'd put that in and it would go grind, grind, grind. And it would eject it. It would say, please put in that. And you would swap the disks back and forth because it would need to like, I'm running the application, but I need the document, but I need the application, but I need the document back and forth, such that you'd see both people with their hands who got good at doing this, like basically using a single hand to catch an auto-ejecting 3.5-inch floppy disk and insert another one back and forth, right? And you had long breaks between, but there was also like mechanisms that would help you with that. That was the dance. It was, again, amazing feat of resource usage that this tiny amount of RAM and the data from the application and the data from the document that you could essentially run the system sort of manually swapping back and forth each resource that the computer needed at the time that it needed it. And it would take forever because floppy disks are slow. You'd have to wait for it to read, find the place, get the data, put a little bit in RAM, eject it, get the other thing back and forth. And then when you wanted to save, you'd have to do the same thing. And then when you quit the application, you'd have to go back to the finder. So you got to put the system disk back in. That experience, to get back to the point of this question, was very formative because, well, for one thing, it showed you kind of the mechanics of multitasking because you are the part of the multitasking system, essentially. You were the meat part of the multitasking system. And you could see, look, it's not doing more than one thing at a time. It's just doing multiple things one after the other, interleaved. You were literally interleaving by swapping disks back and forth. So you could see the mechanics of now the computer needs this. Now the computer needs that. It needs to write here. It needs to read from that. And you knew that there was a limited resource of RAM and that it was, you know, pulling things in and out of there or whatever. And so when multitasking started to slowly arrive with the advent of the Mac Plus, which had 1 megabyte of RAM and hard drives and stuff like that, you could see the mechanics. You could see those mechanics like compressed. Now, but I did eventually get an external floppy drive. Then I'd have 2 floppy disks at the same time and you wouldn't have to swap. One had the operating system, the applications, and the other had your data. And they were both in at the same time. And you would see how much faster that was than swapping disks. It wasn't twice as fast. It was like 50 times as fast because you didn't have to wait for a mechanism to eject a disk and put it back in and everything. It was great. And then the hard drive coming in, right? That was an important experience, I felt like, because it made me appreciate multitasking, made me understand what was going on. And also like the primitive approaches to multitasking, like one of them was called, I think this was called Minifinder. If you were in an application and you wanted to launch another application, you'd have to quit back to the Finder and then find the other application and launch it. Minifinder lets you quit one application, not go all the way back to the Finder, but just go to a Minifinder, which would just be like a little dialogue in your screen that would just show the installed applications that are, you know, that are currently on any disks that are in, right? And launch it from there. You'd be like, that's so dumb. Why not go back to the Finder? Because going back to the Finder, everything took forever. Like, the other thing people don't realize, everything took forever. So you're like, oh, it takes too long to quit back to the Finder. I'd rather quit back to Minifinder and save myself literally 25 seconds every time I want to do this. This was multitasking, right? Oh, I'm in Mac Paint now. I'm going to do great. Yeah, exactly. No, it was way slower than the Kindle. Like, you think the Kindle is
faster than the books tablet.
The Minifinder was a feature, and you're saying, yes, this is what I want. I want to be able to switch between more than one thing at a time without having to wait 67 seconds between things. I want to wait 22 seconds. I can go back to Minifinder, then launch MacWrite. Because I don't want to have to load the whole Finder and all the information that, I didn't have to load the whole Finder program. I wanted to just load Minifinder, right? So coming from that, it's kind of like people who grew up in the Depression and are saving like, you know, boxes and twine and stuff. It's like, you never know when we're going to need this stuff because things are good now and we're able to afford food, but someday we might not. So we've got to save all these containers and save this warm clothing. And, you know, so I feel like I was kind of brought up in Depression era computing resources where I don't expect to have lots of RAM or lots of memory. Which is kind of rich coming from me now, my gigantic computer with my huge screen and my huge amounts of RAM. But maybe that's my reaction to it, is that I'm just like making sure that, as God is my witness, I'll never be RAM hungry again. That's a reference that neither one of you have seen that movie, but it's fine. That's where I'm coming from. And it makes me in some ways appreciate where I am because I came from that and because I grew up doing that. It does not make me nostalgic for those times. I do not have nostalgia, unlike Casey with his vinyl records, for the time when I had to do that. Mm-hmm. When I was doing that, all I wanted was more. 2 floppy drives, a hard drive, like a color screen. I wanted that stuff so bad. And eventually I got it. It just took, you know, decades. and so it makes me appreciate what I have now. And I still have that same attitude, which is like, whatever I have now, I've never felt like, oh, this is probably just about enough. You know, the poor 640K will be enough for anybody, kind of misattributed quote type thing. But that whole idea that we ever arrive at some sort of ending point and computing resources are sufficient is not a thing. No, not an illusion I ever had and ever will experience, because I always wanted more. Because when you see the multitasking with the floppy drives going back and forth, you can see how much better this would be with more computing resources and more money, right? and you know how computing has been improving over your life. And so you can see the future and you want to be there. And that has never changed for me. So I look at my gigantic screen now and my huge Mac or whatever, and I can see, yes, but you know, but could you actually use 10 times more computing resources, 100 times? To say, yes, I totally can, because there's plenty of things that I feel like are not up to snuff and that could be better, right? Do I need a screen that's the size of my house? No, but if you could spray images onto my retinas, I'm all for that, as long as it doesn't burn my retinas out, right? So like I'm not content with the status quo, because I can see how things can get better. And because I've seen how things have advanced and how, you know, where we came from, I see how the pieces fit together. Also helps that I, you know, was a computer engineering major and been a developer for 20 mumble years or whatever. But like, I still feel like I'm traveling that road, and I never feel like I'm going to get to a point where things are satisfactory and I think future further progress is pointless. It just makes me hungry for more.
You know, it's funny hearing you talk about that. I remember, I've brought this story up many times, but I vividly remember, I don't recall exactly when it was, given the house we were in. I want to say it was early 90s, but I remember having an argument with like a distant cousin of mine who was quite a bit older than me, that one could never, it would be impossible to fill a 1 gigabyte hard drive, because he had one for whatever reason. This was long before that was really a thing. And I was like, well, what do you need that for? You would never fill a gigabyte. What could you possibly fill a gigabyte with? It will never happen. And that lasted like a year, maybe two, before that was clearly incorrect. But no, this got me thinking about some of the pain. So that's all the pain that John had to live through. But Marco and I had our own pain. And I know Marco...
Actually, wait, on your 1 gigabyte hard drive story, I think mm-hmm. I said this last time you told the story as well. This is a great example of us not getting quite what we want. I remember having similar conversations about, oh, you know, hard drives are so big, you'll never be able to fill them. And every time I saw a bigger hard drive size, what I would say is, I want to be able to fit all the files from all my past computers, right? All my you know, this is a big box of floppy disks. I want all those floppy disks to be on there. I also want the hard drive of my previous computer, just like, you know, just the whole hard drive. And then I want all my new stuff. And I want to repeat that process for every new computer that I get. So that when I get a new computer, it literally has all my files from all my past computers plus the new files. And I have to say, as fast as hard drives have advanced in size, I have not been able to do that. They're just not big enough. I am bursting at the seams on a 4 terabyte drive on this Mac Pro, and it does not have all my files. Now, all my files from my fast computers are small, but they're not small enough to fit on here. Yeah, my classic Mac OS files could probably fit, but not my previous Mac Pro. That had a multi-terabyte thing too. Mm-hmm. And then the one before that was like maybe 1 terabyte. The one before that was 500 gigs. So I still feel like, boy, if only I had a petabyte, then maybe I could fulfill my dream of all my past computers are on every computer. And when I buy a new computer, it has to be big enough to fit all my past computers. And that's just like starting from zero. Then that's just like the tear button on the scale. And then all my new storage is above that. And we haven't achieved that dream. So keep trying, everybody.
Yeah, we're working on it, right? But no, you know, you were talking about how you had to swap floppies. And I remember doing some of that when I was really little. The difference, though, is that your computer was fancy enough that it would actually eject the floppy itself, whereas Marco and I had to hit a button in order to eject the floppy.
But you could hit that anytime you wanted to just destroy all your files, because your computer's from garbage.
Let's not go too far. But yes,
yes, auto eject and auto inject. Let's not forget the auto inject, because when you're swapping floppies back and forth, which I was doing all the time, auto inject is you'd press it in and it would get you. There's like a spring force that you'd feel. And instead of like on a PC where you had to shove it all the way in with your thumb and then close the little door, you would push it in. And this is 3.5 inch, not 5 1/4. 5 1/4 slid in smooth and then you could turn the door. 3.5 inch, there was always spring resistance, but on a PC, you had to shove it all the way in. But on Macs, they had auto inject and auto eject. And inject meant that once you pressed it past a certain point, it would suck it out of your hand and go in. So you didn't have to shove your thumb all the way into the mouth of your computer. You just push it in a little bit. And of course, auto eject means it would go and the disk would pop out by an inch, right?
Meanwhile, we saw this with a button and it worked fine.
Yeah, auto inject true. And auto eject were essential if your life was spent swapping 400K floppy disks. And even when it was the swapping wasn't there, auto inject and auto eject were definitely differentiated Macs from PCs, as did the 3.5 inch floppy disk, because 5 1/4 were literally floppy and you know, had exposed magnetic media and were just barbaric, and 3.5 were obviously superior.
Yes, but the PCs got those very shortly after the Macs.
Not that shortly. Smart. At least not in childhood years. Because, you know, when you're a kid, like, you know, from the age of like 7 to 8, seems like a millennia, you know, with them when you're 30, from 35 to 36, you don't even remember. Anyway, it's like that.
So, yeah. So back in the day that, and I forget, Marco, when you had a computer in the house, but I know you 94. Were exposed to them. Okay. So when I was little, I remember wanting to play various computer games like Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? And shoot, I'm trying to remember what else.
The first SimCity.
Mm-hmm, sure. Then eventually SimCity 2000, much, much, much later. But early on, when I was first exposed to DOS, like Windows, that's disk operating system, that was the absolutely barbaric version of what John was doing on his fancy Mac. You know, there was no Windows. If it existed, it had not reached mainstream at this point. It probably did exist, but you know, nobody was using it at this point. And so we had to do everything via the command line. And I've told the story many times. I'll tell it very briefly again. That, you know, I was always asking my dad for help. Like, Dad, how do you do this? How do you do that? How do you do this? How do you do that? And eventually, you know, for all my dad's many perks, patience is not one of them. And eventually he literally handed me the DOS 3.3, I believe, owner's manual or user's manual or whatever, and said, just read this. And I did. And here I am, you know, 30 years later. But anyway, what Marco and I had to manage was we had to write our own config.sys, because remember, it's 8.3 file names, John's favorite thing in the world. We had to write our own config.sys, which would explain to the computer what, like, the sort of kind of drivers it would need to load. And we had to write our own autoexec.bat, which would then, you know, finish the startup process by, you know, running different things after the computer had reached like a bare minimum level of functionality. And I remember vividly that I would have to make a decision and like swap my config sys and autoexec bat files with different ones based on whether or not I needed a mouse, because to load the mouse driver used some of, I think it was 640K of conventional memory. And then you also had like RAM on top of that, but conventional memory was where stuff like drivers sat. And so I needed to be aware of whether or not the game I was about to play needed the mouse and run the right config.sys and autoexec bat in order to make sure that I have either enabled or disabled the mouse. Because if I don't need the mouse, I want to save some of that conventional memory, because some of the games I'm playing, they're like bumping up against the edge of the available conventional memory that I have right now. It's barbaric. It was ridiculous. I also remember, and this is probably something that Marco can chime in on, you know, when the Sound Blaster came out, when, you know, sound cards came out and things like that, you needed to do like this whole dance with interrupt request ports, IRQ ports, and make sure that you like told the software and the hardware, okay, you want the Sound Blaster and IRQ 12 or whatever the case may be. And that was always a freaking nightmare, because you never knew which one was the right one. And then as I got a little bit older, I would write like, you know, menuing systems for my autoexec bat. So it would be like this ridiculous, think of it as shell scripts, but like this ridiculous menuing system where, you know, you would click, or you would type, okay, a G for games, and it would bring up a new menu for all the games you could play, and it would load them up and whatever. This is what we did, because we didn't have a graphical user interface. We just kind of faked it.
And remember, this is on 640 kilobytes of RAM, massively mm-hmm. more than 128. Even more so than the original. People always talk about the original iPhone and how amazing it was that it was so smooth and responsive for the incredibly limited hardware of the time. But the 128K Mac is kind of, in a way that no other product except maybe a couple of well-known game consoles were, like, they were able to wring out such amazing performance of such incredibly limited hardware. A full GUI with the mouse driver always loaded in 128 kilobytes with like not a shell on top of a command line thing, but a full GUI operating system from top to bottom with everything working with, you know, sound card, like, you know, full, like, it was, I think it was like 22 kilohertz sound, so it wasn't CD quality, but it wasn't like the bleeps and boops of the, you know, MS-DOS thing. So you had a quote-unquote sound card, like everything a more modern PC wouldn't have for such a long time, with so much more resources that they've somehow managed to get to work on a 120. And obviously it didn't stay at 128 for long. 512 came out, then 1 megabyte, and it ramped up pretty quick. But that's why, like, the tales of the original Mac team are fun to read. Is it's kind of like reading, you know, kind of like Apollo 13. You've got to fix this problem, and you've got this set of stuff and some tape, right? Can you make these parts into a complete GUI operating system? No, you can't have more RAM. No, you can't have a bigger screen. Like, no, you can't have a hard drive. Good luck. And that's why, you know, Mac users are insufferable. And the only time I had to deal with autoexec bat and config.sys was when I was at my friend's house trying to get PC games to run. And then you got to play with both of those files until the game ran. And then I just, you know, I played the game and I left.
Yep. Yep, it was the worst. And speaking of the worst, I remember when my dad and I originally wanted to get an internet service provider, an ISP, we needed to figure out how to use the modem. And so we had to write our own. I don't know why this was the case, but I vividly remember doing this. We spent literally like a week writing the Hayes, like AT.
No, everybody had to do that. That was just part of being on the internet back then. Yep. Even on the Mac, when I had to, you know, run my Z modem thing, I knew the AT modem and its strings and all that stuff.
Yep. We had to do that by hand. There was no documentation anywhere. You just kind of threw junk against the wall and hoped for the best.
You get the documentation on the internet, though.
Well, yeah, but you got to get on the internet to get the documentation.
I know,
it's
a chicken egg, but good thing was I was in college then, so I could just go down to the computer lab and look up stuff.
Yeah, if somebody says plus on a podcast, does it mute and disconnect?
Yeah. Fair. And then, you know, so at this point, you know, you really want to play games with your friends, and you could do dial up, you know, where you could literally dial your friend's house using the game software and it would create a connection. You could play each other, you know, over dial up, which was impossibly slow, and you couldn't do anything other than play the game. There was no chatting with them in most cases. You just played the game. That was that. And then eventually, you know, we got to the point that we wanted to do quote unquote LAN parties, but LANs weren't a thing, or at least not for kids my age. So what we would do is we would bring our tower computers and our 7,000 pound CRT monitors that were only 13 inches, and we would bring them to our friends' houses. And then we would set them up in a very small and very stinky room where you would use something called a serial cable. So it was a serial cable, but I think it was like a crossover on the inside. So you could connect two serial ports to, you know, a serial port on one machine to a serial port on another machine, and then you could play each other locally, which was so much better than doing it over dial-up because it had, by comparison, infinite bandwidth. And then over time, there was some modicum of networking in DOS, like IPX networking, and there was eventually some software, I know I've talked about this several times in the past, called Kali, K-A-L-I, which would mimic IPX networking but do it over TCP/IP, so you could do these games, all these like old DOS games that were never intended to be played on the internet, you could now play on the internet, which was amazing. And then the other fun thing about being on the internet is, you know, when you had your one ISP, well, what happens if you happen to have a laptop and happen to have a modem and you happen to go traveling? Well, in order to get on the internet, you would have to dial your ISP, which is presumably a local ISP in your area code. So if I was traveling away from Richmond, I would be making a long distance phone call. That was also a thing, to something in the 804 area code. And so then I would be accruing charges potentially from the ISP. I'd be accruing charges for the long distance call. And it was a mess. And that was the one time I was jealous of America Online users, was because AOL had, you know, endpoints, if you will, everywhere. And there was like a database inside the AOL app. And you would just say, okay, well, here's where I am. And you would go scroll, Richmond, Virginia, scroll. Okay, there. That looks like a local number. And then you could dial your local number and not have to pay long distance charges to get on, quote unquote.
What was your ISP that didn't have local numbers? What were you using?
No, I was, it was local when I was in, I wasn't in Richmond at the time, but the sake of discussion, it was local to Richmond.
Yeah, but what was that ISP?
Oh, God, I don't remember. It was forever ago. I think it was
there used
North
to be
American
local ISPs. Like it would be like, you know, an ISP in your region.
I remember having the same situation. Like, so I knew the BU number, 353-5000, but I don't call that. I don't know if it's still a modem. So I guess it was 617. You know, and I could call it from campus and I could long distance it from home during the summer. Because this is the other thing to remember. So like my first experience with the internet was at college in 1993, I guess. But when I came home for the summer, where'd the internet go? It's back at college, right? So like Casey, I could call on my modem, which I brought home with me. I could call the BU dial-up number, but it's long distance to Boston, right? So I had, you know, rather than doing that, I to get a quote unquote local ISP, but even then, even in 93, I think I had Netcom. And Netcom was a, I guess, semi-national ISP, and they had dial-up numbers in most major metropolitan areas. So I got to call a New York dial-up number to get on the internet. And then I could hop over to the BU stuff or whatever.
Yeah, see, I was at this point, that was not what I had. And I, racking my brain, I am pretty sure this was when we were living in Austin, Texas. And I'm pretty sure it was North American Internet, and the domain for it was NAI.net. And I just went to it, and it's like been bought up 1,000 times. It's not what it is anymore. But I'm pretty sure when we were in Austin, when we were writing the, you know, modem codes and so on and so forth, the Hayes codes, I'm pretty sure it was NAI.net. I'm almost sure of it. And they only had they were only established in Austin. Or again, maybe it wasn't Austin, but I'm pretty sure it was. And that's what we had. That was it. And it was, Dad had a tremendous advantage because IBM obviously had like endpoint, I don't know what you would call them, but like endpoints everywhere. And so I could get on the internet briefly and like check my email using Dad's work dial up. But it was just a very, very different time. Like, you know, when we wanted to transfer a file from one person to another, you would put it on a diskette or a disk, depending on how old you are and what you would want to call it. And you would walk it to somebody else and hand them that disk. And now you have transferred that file because there was no internet.
You might have transferred the file. You have to actually read it off the disk to see if it was actually readable first.
Yeah, that's another archaic thing from all of our youths is a subject of advertising and competition in the computing marketplace was surrounding file format compatibility. It's part of the reason why Macs were like boxed out of the business market or whatever. And there was all sorts of Mac products like, this will let you open files from PCs. Like the notion was that basically, if you had a PC, any of the files that you made in that PC, the Mac could do nothing with, and vice versa, right? Which is a concept that's mostly foreign to people these days, because basically we've set it on standardized formats. Like for images, for example, they're all JPEGs, PNGs, blah, those are not platform-specific file formats. Like, you know, through the magic of the web, the platform that nobody owns, the web pages can be viewed from different platforms, the images can be viewed, and we still have Microsoft Word and stuff like that. But it used to be that literally every single file you made, no matter what it was, no matter what was in it, oh, you made that on a PC? Well, of course a Mac can't read that without some special software. The nodes had to read PC files because there was no standardized format and no internet to sort of force that standardization. And that whole concept has mostly disappeared, especially now that if any application is remotely viable on any platform, it's probably cross-platform. Like, there are very few, I guess there are probably a bunch of Mac programs that don't exist on the PC, and I suppose vice versa, but like, Microsoft Word is everywhere. Every image format is readable everywhere. Photoshop is everywhere. You know, like the portability of data is much better now. And I mean, like in terms of being able to read it, even if we're not carrying floppy disks around. So yeah, if I could take my Mac floppy disk. PCs couldn't even read the Mac floppy disk. They would ask to initialize it, or they would, however they would.
Format,
the PC would
John.
Say that.
The word is format. Format.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This disk is uninitialized. Would you like to initialize it? Yeah, I know that message well. Yeah. and vice versa for a long time, that if you had a quote unquote PC disk and you brought it to a Mac, unless you have, you could tell the Mac was the lesser platform, like the less market share, because on the Mac, there were tons of utilities and stuff to help you read files from the PC, read DOS formatted floppies, much less so in the other direction because, you know, Windows didn't have to, so why would it?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't even have, like, text encoding. So, like, you know, this was before Unicode. So
we had ASCII, but, like, nothing stored stuff in ASCII. Once word processing started to have, like, bold and italic, it's, like, so much for even RTF is, I mean, RTF is still kind of a horror show, but that was close as we got to style, cross-platform style text before the beautiful advent of PDF and HTML and all those other things.
Man, you guys and your fancy modems and ISPs and computers, before 1994. I had a very different experience. See, you both had the advantage that that your parents were a little bit more computer friendly. In Casey's case, a lot more computer friendly, I think.
Yeah, my parents weren't computer friendly. They were susceptible to other people telling them that this is the thing they need to do for the kid, but they knew nothing. Casey actually had a computer knowledgeable parent. I did not.
Yeah, but you at least had like computer enabling parents.
yes, for sure.
I did not have that. My mom, number one was, my mom, super non-technical. My dad died when I was very, very young. So I was raised by a single mom. We didn't have any money really. Like, we weren't poor. We were, lower middle class. We got by, but we couldn't buy fancy stuff at all. And the only reason we were able to get a computer is that one of my grandmothers had passed away and left us like $2,000. And so we used that to buy our first computer in 94. It was a wonderful Gateway 2000 PC.
I love those.
A 486
so much
PC running Windows 3.11 for work groups. And a black and white inkjet printer, which existed then. But anyway, so because we really didn't have any money, that was... We were able to buy this computer like once in 94, but then not really able to upgrade it ever. So I was using that 1994 486 computer until 1998 or 1999. Like, it couldn't run Windows 95. So I entirely skipped Windows 95. I didn't use it at all. I went straight from 3.1 to a very short-lived stay on 98.
And by the way, people are saying, so what? You use a five-year-old computer. Who cares? You
don't know how fast
computers were changing. The 5 years from 1994 to 1998 were very different than the 5 years from 2015 to 2020, for example.
Yes.
Very different.
Yes.
Things were changing so fast. That's where all the jokes about, oh, you buy it and you bring it home, it's obsolete. Things were getting better so fast at that point that a five-year-old computer was like, why even bother?
Right. And even the, you know, it wasn't even top of the line when we bought it, because we bought like a mid-range one. $2,000 bought a mid-range desktop, not a top-of-the-line desktop in 94. So anyway.
It's still true of Apple today.
Yeah, but this was Gateway 2000.
I know. It was $2,000 in 1994 money. But just, anyway.
Yeah. But anyway, so that computer... That was like, and I was entirely self-taught, because my mom was very, very non-technical, and my sister didn't care, and that was it. That was the whole household: my mom, my sister, and me. So I was the only. It was in my room because no one else cared, which is great. And I like that computer. I used that for so long. And again, going back to the not really having any money thing, no one in my house was going to agree that we should pay for a dial-up account or even a modem. So. For the first few years of having that computer, for the first year, I didn't have any connectivity to the internet, because that wasn't actually a given. Like, why you'd get a computer? It wasn't to put it on the internet. Like, there was barely any internet at all back then. So for the first like year or so or two that I had it, I just used local software. I would play around in MS Paint or use Microsoft Word, figure out various things, play some games that I would like buy on CDs. Like, you'd go to a store in the mall. And you'd buy like that CD that had, it would say like 200 games, and it was all shareware demos. It was like 200 shareware demos for $10 on this. So I'd have like the first two levels of 200 different games that all sucked. So that was my gaming situation for a while. I had to add on the sound card and CD-ROM as a set for Christmas that following Christmas, because like it would have been too much to get that with the computer. I got the computer in spring 94, and then in December 94, I got the Sound Blaster 16 sound card with CD-ROM combo. The sound card actually drove the CD-ROM drive. Like, it had the sound card itself.
Oh, my word.
Had a ribbon cable, and I don't even know what protocol it spoke, but it was probably some early like form of ATA, and that drove the CD-ROM drive.
Didn't the joystick also plug into the sound card sometimes?
Yes, it did. I didn't have a joystick, but yeah, game pads, yeah, they would plug in. Anyway, so that computer lasted me... a long time, because it had to the point where it even lasted me into the early internet usage. But again, like, I didn't have a modem, because we couldn't buy a modem because they were expensive, and who the hell was going to buy a modem and then buy an ISP? So eventually some like friend of my mom's felt sorry for me and gave me like a hand-me-down first I got a hand-me-down 2400 baud modem, and this was in like probably like 1996. Like, it was way late for that speed. It was this giant thing, and I remember like I was playing with Visual Basic at the time, and I needed somehow I had lost my copy of the vbrun whatever .dll file that you need to run. It's like the runtime for Visual Basic project. You need it to run anything from Visual Basic, so I had to download a copy of it. So somebody told me about some BBS. I had to like dial up this BBS and try to download this 300 kilobyte file on a 2400 baud modem. Which I'm not going to do the math now, but I think it ended up it needed like 2 hours or something. And
do you remember how much 2400 baud modem cost at that point? Because you got the used one, right? Like, why couldn't you buy one new? Like, what was how much
it was?
Did they cost?
It was a hand me down. Like, I don't know, but at the time the current speed at the time was like 28.8. So it was.
Oh, that's right. So you weren't all right. It was. I was trying to remember. Like, my first modem was also 2400, but that was the fastest speed you could get at the time.
Yeah, no, this was, and that was not the case in like 1995, 1996, whenever this was.
Yeah, no, you definitely are offset by several years in history. I was just looking up one Christmas. I asked for I got my second floppy drive, which, as as I previously said, is super important. That second floppy drive in today's dollars was $1,200.
Oh my word!
For a 400K external floppy drive, that's all it did.
That's bananas. And just to build on what Marco was saying, by the way, I don't know if I have the words to express how slow a 2400 baud modem is. Like,
you could watch the characters appearing. And
so no, that is 1000%. I again, vivid memory. This is early in my computing life, early. I have a vivid memory of using Prodigy, which we briefly had an account on, and you would literally watch the text come in as it was being downloaded. One
like you see in movies today.
Yep,
today, right. You go to a movie and you'll see some kind of thing, and not only will you see the letters appear one at a time like they did over a 1200, 2400 baud modem, but they'll each one will make a beep.
Well, now,
still
now,
today in modern
now you
movies,
can watch all
understand.
The large language models very slowly generating text.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But it's thinking. It's not taking time to transfer it.
Right. But yeah, that was like my whole internet experience growing up was really weird because so I came to it late. I had very, very basic that computer was so basic for the internet that like I when MP3s were starting to become a thing was right at the end of me having that computer. My first two MP3s I had on that 486 computer with a 400 meg hard drive. So not only could, you know, but after I've been using this computer for like 4 years, the hard drive was nearly full. So to add like a 3 megabyte MP3 was a big deal for a 400 megabyte hard drive. And a 486 can't play MP3s in real time. It's too slow to decode them. So I had to actually play them at like 22 kilohertz. Like I had to cut the quality and just not decode the upper frequency range because it was too slow.
I bet somebody could make an MP3 decoder written in assembly for a 486 that would work.
Maybe. I mean, this was obviously very early in MP3 days, so I'm sure it wasn't that optimized yet, but it was bad. But anyway,
it was written in Pascal.
Yeah, eventually a family friend for like some other birthday or Christmas gift bought me a 33.6 modem, and then that changed everything. That was like, oh my god, now I can actually dial things. But the problem was, still didn't have an ISP because my family wasn't going to pay $20 a month, and I was like a young teenager. I couldn't do that myself. So I had a rich friend though, whose dad had an AOL account. and this was right before AOL went flat rate. You were still paying like whatever, like $3 an hour to use it. But he would let me occasionally sign in to a screen name that he created in his account. Problem is, AOL accounts wouldn't allow account sharing. So if somebody was signed in, you couldn't sign in also to the same account. So I would have to leave the call waiting non-disabled on my modem init string, leave call waiting enabled, and change the init string so the modem speaker would stay on the whole time. So the whole time I'm using the internet, I'm hearing next to me. And if I heard boop, if I heard that call waiting beep come in, I would have to flip the modem off so it would hang up, instantly disconnect. I'd pick up the phone, hey, sorry, and you know, hang up. And then he'd go sign on his account, like from his house. It was terrible thing.
This is also, I had moments of this as well. I think specifically with AOL, I don't know why. Maybe I really wanted to get on AOL specifically because there was something I wanted there. That's probably what it was. But you would find a friend, like Marco was describing, whose parents had an AOL account. And then he would either, they would give you a login or something like that. But like Marco said, if the parent wanted to get online or the kid wanted to get online, you don't want them to especially the parent to see, oh, you know, Casey is online. What the hell is this? How is Casey online?
Yeah, right.
And you know, so you had to be like, you had to be real committed when you dialed up with somebody else's account, and you had to be real sure you were real fast with whatever you were trying to do, because it was like super dangerous, not in a literal sense, but it was like dangerous. You don't want the parent to know that you're leeching off their account, especially during the time that it wasn't unlimited, because yeah, for a long time, ISPs were like, particularly AOL was billed hourly. It was billed by the time you used. And so, yeah, this was like the most dangerous game. That's a reference. And it was so stressful and so frustrating. I mean, again, as I was thinking about this topic earlier today, like we just assume that the internet is everywhere. I'm not even talking about our cell phones, just in general. Like every building you go in today probably has the internet running through it in some way, shape, or form. And that could not have been further from the truth.
Yeah, like I said, I came home from college. I left the internet behind because the internet was in school. Exactly. But I came back to my house. My house didn't have the internet. Where does the internet come into your house from? And so I had to, like, I brought my modem home, but the only thing I could dial was the Boston University number. And so I was just like, I got to get an ISP. And then we had the, you know, well, we only have one phone line, and I essentially wanted to be on the internet 24 hours a day, which was incompatible to having with having a phone. So how do you figure that out? And I did actually, we did have AOL and some other things like that. Which I despised, right? Because my first experience was my first experience was with the real internet, so I could see that AOL was not where I wanted to be. Something you both said reminded me of another thing that from my computing past that gives me a different perspective on computers. I just mentioned that, like, when you with the original Macintosh, when you turned it on, it would make a little beep, the screen would come on, and then it would show a floppy disk icon with a question mark on it, and it would be blinking. It's basically saying, you know, disk, you got to stick in a disk, right? That's all the Mac did when you turned it on, right? But I had had computers before that. Like I said, my first computer was a VIC-20, which we rented, not bought, because it was too expensive to buy. So you used to be able to rent computers. I don't know how much the rental cost, but presumably it was cheaper than buying. Anyway, VIC-20, I think this is true of Commodore 64, Commodore PET, like my original computers, right? If you took that out of the box and you turned it on, it didn't have a blinking floppy disk icon. It didn't have graphics, right? And you connected it to your television. That was your monitor, right? But those early computers, when you turn them on, I mean, I don't know, did you experience any computers? When you turn them on, what do they do?
Oh, gosh, I don't even remember at this point. I think
used anything that old, but I remember, like, you know, the old Apple IIs that I would have in computer school computer labs, like, you just flip it on and it would beep, and it would and the CRT would warm up over a few seconds, and you'd see a cursor.
Yeah.
And you'd see what?
A cursor.
And what can you do with that cursor? What the hell was the cursor there for?
It with those old Apple IIs, it was a basic cursor.
Exactly. Computers, my very first computer and the original personal computers that I experienced from the VIC-20 on, when you turn them on, you got a place where you could type. And what could you type? Basic programs. That, like, a computer was a thing that you programmed. That was what it was. Like, and my VIC-20 did not have a floppy drive or a cassette tape drive or literally anything else. There was no, you turned it on and you got a prompt. What could you do? Well, you could take a computer magazine that you got from the library at school and you could type in a basic program. Or you could type your own basic programs. Or you could make little colorful squares on the screen by figuring out which key makes a different colorful square on the screen, right? But, like, they, like, built into the computers was the basic programming language. And you would type a line number and type a basic thing, and that was it. And you could load your program and run your program and do stuff like that. So, the Mac was a, you know, very big change for me in many ways. Obviously, it was my first GUI computer and the first GUI computer most people have ever seen. But also, the Mac, when you turned it on, there was nothing there. You had to boot into an operating system, run some software, whatever. It did not put you at a basic prompt. It was the first computer I used that was not essentially, this is a tool for writing and running programs. The Mac was a tool for running applications, essentially, programs that other people wrote. And yes, you could write your own programs too, but boy, was it more complicated than basic, let me tell you.
Yeah, I mean, this, like, going back to Torb's question, which I think was great, like, how did all this old stuff, how does it affect our usage patterns today? You know, I think for my story, it's a very complicated mess of lots of these things. Like, you know, from what John was saying a minute ago, like, having programming be just built into everything makes me really resent platforms that lock that away or make it impossible to write software for them or very difficult. I don't love that. I love when computers are programmable themselves. When you can use a computing device and write programs for it on it, I love that. But you know, in general too, like my whole history here with I didn't have much. I couldn't afford upgrades very often. After that 486, I ended up doing a series of self-built computers because that was the way to get a computer less expensively, was build it yourself. Like, and I learned how to do all that, which honestly served me very well. But you know, I learned how to build PCs, how to upgrade PCs, how to get different parts together. I spent so much time building PCs for either myself or for my friends and having to figure out problems that they, you know, so much time of, like, drivers, installing, reinstalling Windows, all, like, why does this hard drive not show up? Like, so many problems, so much time spent dealing with all that crap, so much time spent reinstalling Windows. And as a result, now, I'm fortunate enough that I can buy good hardware now, and so I do, because I went so long without having it. Like, as John was saying, when you're a kid, this feels like an eternity. Like, when I was a teenager, using these slow computers, and I cannot possibly express to anybody who wasn't alive back then how slow everything was. You know, we touched on it a little bit earlier, but just everything was so slow back then. And it really was, it was that slow through the entire 90s. And even the early 2000s, like it wasn't quite as bad once RAM started getting cheaper in the mid 2000s, but it was really slow in the 90s because everything was RAM starved. Everything was, you just hear hard drive grinding noises constantly.
Did you run software off floppy disks? Because that was the switch to hard drives was basically like the switch to SSDs. Like we lived through the switch to SSDs. Like, you would think, well, what's the difference? Floppy disk, hard drive, they're both spinning media. You both got to wait for the disk to spin around to where you are, and you got to move ahead. But boy, was it different. Running, because I ran software off floppy drives for a long time, or it seemed like a long time, and it's the worst. And that was back in the era when you could listen to computers and hear how they're doing, because they made noises, mechanical noises that you could interpret. Yeah. You could interpret their health, and so I'm very familiar with floppy drive noises and what it sounds like when things are going well and not going well. And yeah, so that was a whole other level of slow. There was, I suppose there was cassette tape slow, which is you got to rewind and load the program. And that was like, oh, nothing's happening. We're loading the program. Come back when it's loaded. So that's one level. So the next was floppy disks, which was random access, but super slow. Then there was hard drives. Then there was SSDs. And each of those leaps.
Well, you're skipping a step. You're skipping an important step. And I skipped it earlier too. The CD-ROM drive. Oh,
I'm putting that off to the side because that was like backsliding, because we had hard drives and it's like, yeah, but what if you had a really big hard drive that was incredibly slow?
Like, but no, remember, thanks,
but it's 650 gigs and you can play Myst. All right, fine.
It's not gigs, 650
megs. Sorry, 650 megs.
Yep. Yeah, My favorite part of the CD-ROM era was at the end when they got really fast. Mm-hmm. And so, and everything, like, so, you know, what happened was early CD-ROM drives, they'd be like, you know, 2X, 4X. And
I had a 1X drive.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think it was $800.
Yeah.
When I bought it in whatever 1990s money that was.
That's rough.
Oh, yeah. We had one of those too. We had one of those too. And again, a differentiator between the Mac and a PC was our original CD-ROM drive, which was external. You had to put the CD in a caddy.
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah. The first Mac drive was in a caddy too. It just
was it? Okay.
As much as the PC one.
Yeah. It was probably SCSI. Yeah. But yeah, like, you know,
it was cuz of
you. My favorite part is like when we got to the like the 52X CD-ROM era of the mid 2000s.
It's too fast.
So every time the CD would be accessed, everything on the computer would freeze and for like 4 seconds and you hear,
and it was like a plane
spin
taking
up,
off.
And it was cuz it had to spin up to its ridiculous spindle speed and it wouldn't read anything until it was spun all the way up. So it would have this, like, you know, this 4 second like just lock of whatever was trying to read it would just freeze for a few seconds, and you hear this jet engine taking off in your computer. And that was normal for probably 6 years, 7 years. Like, for a long time, every CD-ROM drive in a PC did that. Like, they all did.
That reminds me, speaking of multitasking, so on the original Mac, you know, I just described how you couldn't run more than programming at once, but you couldn't do more than one thing at once because the resources were so limited. The famous example is if you held down a pull-down menu, I've already talked about how you couldn't click a menu, right? So if you click the mouse button and held it down on the file menu, everything on the computer would stop. Nothing else is happening. All it's doing is concentrating on drawing that menu for you. Any program that, like Mac Paint, it stopped doing anything. Nothing else is happening, right? Same thing was true for floppy drives in the Finder, right? If you were copying a file from a floppy drive, right, to the other floppy drive, if you were lucky enough to have two of them or whatever, nothing else is happening while that copy is happening. There's a system modal dialogue showing a progress bar. You could do literally nothing else, right? You couldn't go mess around in the Finder, do something else. It was like, you're just going to watch that progress bar go, yeah, as it copies the stuff, right? And the reason I bring this up is because, like, that era of like, oh, it's the floppy drive era. No one has any RAM. Multitasking is too expensive, right? Like, everything, you know, if you have a GUI computer, like, you're not going to be able, right? By the time we got multitasking, everyone had hard drives and it, like, that kind of fit. But I had this one sort of discontinuous experience where somebody I knew had an OS2 computer, right? Like an OS2 PC with a floppy drive. And in the whatever it was, maybe Casey knows, what was the file manager called in OS2? Some work shell thing or whatever.
Oh, gosh. Yes, I know what you're thinking of, but I don't know.
Anyway, it's the Finder equivalent in OS 2. And he was showing me his OS2 computer, and I was like, yeah, yeah, Macs are better, blah, blah, blah. And then he copied a file from a floppy drive. I think he copied it from a floppy onto his hard drive. And then he started to do other things. I'm like, you can't do anything but you're copying from a floppy drive. What witchcraft is this? Because it has been so burned into my brain that when you're doing, like Margo was saying, with like CD-ROM, like when you're waiting for that thing to spin up, nothing else is happening. Like, it's just you're waiting for an IO. And I had lived so long with the idea with like, oh, so you're copying something from a floppy drive? That is literally the only thing your computer is doing right now. You can't even use anything else in the file manager. But then in OS 2, you could copy something from a floppy drive and go do something else. And it was like this amazing, the magic of preemptive multitasking. That's when I knew the Mac needed a new operating system.
That was it. That was the moment.
Yeah, I knew before that. But you know, it was still like, it blew my mind in a way that like, it hadn't even occurred to me that this is a thing an operating could do. Just because the floppy disk was from the era when you couldn't do that. Of course, when you copy from hard drives, you can do other stuff, but not a floppy drive, because that was like so associated with the era when all there were floppy drives.
See, this is like...
No, it's...
Like, I, like, you know, you here you are like wondering about like, you know, we need a new operating system. For me, my operating system at the time, which was Windows, it was just telling me over and over again every couple of months when I'd have to reinstall the whole thing to make it work right, I should be using a different operating system. like that's why, you know, I ended up jumping ship to Mac in about 2004. But it like, I, and you know, looking back through this history, like all the computers I built. All the time I spent debugging Windows and managing drivers, mm-hmm. and got to install the NVIDIA driver so the screen resolution fixes itself, and oh, now it's conflicting with the weird SCSI driver for the CDR.
Yeah, like, you could have been just debugging SCSI termination problems like Mac users.
I know, like that entire history. That's why, you know, going back to Tor, like how it affects my usage pattern today. That's why I have zero patience now for dealing with OS bugs and cruft and having to reinstall or restore things and having to reset everything up. I hate doing that now because I spent my entire youth doing that and not getting much else done. And, you know, I at the time it was vaguely fun because it was all I had to do and it was the only hardware I had, and so fine. But then as soon as I switched to Mac, like I got a Mac laptop in 2004 because I needed a laptop and they were good. I was instantly hooked on Mac OS, and my PC usage quickly fell off, and I quickly stopped buying PCs because it was just so much better for my purposes. Like at that point, I was so burnt out from just the overhead of having a PC and trying to keep it in working order. I was so burnt out from that, even though I liked it for a while, I was ready to move on, and the Mac was that way to move on, and I was so thankful to do it. And even and at the time, you know, I still couldn't afford much. So, you know, the Mac I had was not super fast. But, man, it was so much better in terms of, like, not having to deal with a bunch of crap. And then I fell in love with all the, you know, nice little details and the delightfulness and the power user features and the good design. What got me there was I wanted a good laptop that I didn't have to mess with all the time. And it was just so, so good. And that's why, like, again, like, if you look at me today, like, what we all joke about today, like, oh, I keep buying stuff, and I, you know, if something doesn't work, I get rid of it. Like, yeah, because I spent my entire youth not being able to buy anything and with tons of stuff that didn't work. So now I went the other opposite direction. You know, now I'm, like, you know, totally, like, I have no patience for, you know, any hardware that's insufficient for my needs or stuff that doesn't work very well or stuff I have to manage and mess with a lot. No patience for that whatsoever. I got better things to do now. I paid my dues. I've moved on.
In 2004, did you care about the Unix, the fact that, you know, the Mac was Unix under the covers, or was that not yet a factor in your decisions?
No, that wasn't a factor at all. I didn't really know to what degree that was the case yet.
Did you, this is before you were in like PHP, doing the web stuff and everything like that?
It was right when that was starting, because it was when I graduated from college. Like, right after I graduated from college, I was starting to move around a lot, and I wanted something portable, and I had always, like, ventured into the Mac section of Micro Center. You know, like, they would always have, like, this sectioned-off room, like, mm-hmm. sectioned-off with glass walls from the rest of Micro Center, and that would be the little, like, Mac paradise. And you'd go in there, and you'd, like, shrink the windows, and you see the Genie effects. This was early
OS 10.
I'm not
sure paradise is the word I would use to describe it. It was... more like a little prison, or,
the Mac prison with nice, you know, the Mac area, you know, it would have like
the Mac was marginalized in retail stores. This is the reason Apple opened its own stores.
Yeah, but at least you knew that, like, if you had a Mac, at least you knew you could go in there and you could see the four apps they actually had for the Mac that you could buy.
This was 2004. This was 2004 though, so this is post iMac. This is post Mac OS X. If you remember, in the bad old days, if you went into a store that sold computers before Mac OS X, before the iPod, before the iMac, there was a section with Macs, and it was sneered upon by everybody, and it was not well-loved. The only place that I ever experienced that had any kind of well-loved display of Mac hardware was a place that didn't even sell Mac hardware, and that's Egghead Software, because they would have a Mac there, a fancy Mac that you couldn't afford because it costs as much as your house, and they would show it running the Mac applications that they sold. Egghead treated its Macs well, but nobody else did. You remember Egghead? That was national chain, right?
Yeah, I remember it.
I don't think we had them.
I don't think we had them, but I remember it being a thing that I was aware of.
That's where I had to go to be, because I was reading all the Mac magazines. I had a subscription to Mac User and Mac World. I tried to get a subscription to Mac Week by lying about who I was, and I could never pull it off. So I had to read Mac Week from the desks of relatives' offices where they got it.
Not those big sticks to the library?
Yeah, or something I could get them there. But the only place I could go to see the things that I was reading in magazines was Egghead Software, because I couldn't afford a color Mac. They cost, I was just looking it up today, a Mac 2, the very first color Macintosh with the default smallest possible color monitor that was 13 inches, $17,000 in today's money. So that's why I didn't have a Mac 2. But if I wanted to see one in person, it was like going to see like a Lamborghini at the car show. You're not going to own one, but if you want to see one in person, I'd go to Egghead Software, and they had a Mac 2 set up. And then I could be like, there it is. I can touch it, right? And the people at the store wouldn't yell at you. Eventually, that went downhill, too, because you'd go see the poor Mac that was sitting in Egghead Software, which eventually was like some terrible performa, right? And all of the desktop would be 100 folders named ZZZZZ from little kids who would just like make a new folder and just put it, mash their hands on the keyboard. It was sad. But for a while there, it was nice.
Thank you so much to our sponsor this week, which is you, the audience. You know, we decided to do a special episode this week where we are entirely audience supported this episode. So our wonderful ATP store, not merch store, John, our wonderful ATP store, you can buy merchandise there. And thank you so much to our members who support us directly. You've made this show possible this week, and you can join us if you're not a member yet, atp.fm/join, and we will talk to you next week.
So I had an idea. I don't know if it's a good idea, but I had an idea. We haven't done it yet, so I don't want anyone to get too excited and go looking right now. But it occurred to me.
Oh, yeah, I got to do this.
You don't have to do it right this minute.
Argo's doing it in real time while Casey talks. It's a race.
I hope I'll just edit the file right on the publisher.
It's really easy to do.
Who cares?
Casey doesn't know web development.
Oh, stop. I did plenty of web development.
Edit it in production. The old ways are best.
I always edit it in production.
Oh, God. Jeezy peasy.
It's fine. Emacs makes a temporary file and then renames it atomically when you save.
Anyway, I had an idea. I want to make it plain. I'm not trying to be funny. I want to make it plain. I am reserving the right to take this idea back. I'm reserving the right to cancel it all. I'm reserving the right to say just kidding for any reason I so desire. But I thought it would be neat if, as a kind of accidental membership perk, what if we/I put a link to the test flight for my forthcoming app on your member page, right next to your ATP store discount, or maybe really above or below or nearby, one way or the other.
You mean Flukup?
It's pronounced Flukup.
It's pronounced Flukup. Thank you very much. And no, it's trading under a different name now. It's doing business as D/B/A. But anyways, I think what I'm going to try is we're going to put a link to the test flight for the app into the ATP membership page where you would find your store discount and so on and so forth. But here's the deal. First of all,
done.
Look at that. Problem solved. If you, or whenever the app is officially released, I'm going to kill everyone's access. Like, I'm telling you right now, when the app is out for real, this beta is going away. Additionally, I am reserving the right to cancel it at any time for any reason whatsoever. This is a for fun perk that members have for 5 minutes or more, depending on how I feel about the whole thing. I thought it would be fun to give it a shot. And if I'm completely honest, that link will work for anyone under the sun. But here's the thing. I limited it to roughly the membership count of ATP members right now. So if you share that link with other people, you're taking away from one of your fellow ATP members. Don't be that person. Don't be that person. That's not cool. Don't do that. Keep the link for yourself, please, and thank you.
No, honestly, I think we can trust our members. So most people don't know this. I actually, when we were building the CMS, when I was building the CMS, not letting Casey.
There was no we about it, which was both great and occasionally annoying, but mostly.
I added the JavaScript show notes validator. It's a very important part of the system that Casey loves.
I love it so much.
So when I was building the CMS, you know, we were building it to support a membership program, and so I built it that way from the start, but I wasn't sure, like, are people going to, like, pirate our member episodes and put them all over, you know, and just, you know, then make a bunch of feeds for other people to get our member episodes without paying? And I was actually really worried about that. And so I built this whole system to fingerprint the MP3s that were served, to embed, like, a member ID in various areas of the MP3 that, like, wouldn't affect the audio playback, because of my work with Overcast, I know of a lot of ways to do that. A lot of places that you can shove stuff in the MP3 format and not be seen, really, and not be a problem. And so I actually built this whole thing to, like, serve files with individual member IDs embedded in them so that if anybody ever did start sharing stuff, we could, like, you know, cut off their account or whatever. And I ended up disabling it in a later update because that just hasn't been a problem. Like, no one does that. or effectively no one does it. And so I want to just express how much I appreciate that to our members, that, like, you're not, like, ripping us off. Like, you're not being jerks with our stuff. Like, I really appreciate that. And, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, that our previous statement that we have the best audience in the world really is true. Like, you know, other podcasts, I'm sure, your audiences are great. We have the best audience. Like, let's be honest. Like, you all out there, you're the best. Like, you are the best. We very much appreciate that. So thank you very much. And so I think, with all that said, I think we can trust them not to share your test flight link.
Yes, or at least please. For some percentage of them not to be interested in testing the program, leaving the other ones for pirates.
I guess that's one way of looking at it, isn't it? But yeah, so the link is currently, as I record this right now, it is sitting, thank you, Marco, on your member page just below where you can find your store discount code. Again, I want to stress, I'm just trying this out. I thought it would be a fun experiment. I might kill it tomorrow. We don't know, but we're going to give it a shot and see what happens.
I think the one good thing about this is if you're listening to this and you're like, you know, what is test flight? How do I use a beta of an iOS application? Even if you have no interest in Casey's application, just going through the test flight experience is fun. Test flight used to be a third party company that Apple bought, and now it's part of the Apple developer experience. It's pretty easy. You'll go there and you'll see a link and, like, what am I supposed to do with this URL? If you go to that URL on your phone, I think it'll show you something that says basically, hey, step one, get the Test Flight app, and then it'll have a link to the App Store where you'll download an app called Test Flight with a little blueprint of a propeller on it. And then it will say, step two, after you've installed the Test Flight app, tap this link and it will open the Test Flight application and it will say, hey, do you want to join the Test Flight app for Casey's app? And you'll say yes. And then you'll see a list of applications that you have in Test Flight, which will just be the one you did. And there'll be a button for you to install it, and it'll install it on your phone, and it'll just appear like any other application on your phone. And every time Casey pushes a new update to the test flight, it'll automatically update itself or not. I think there's some setting for it. But anyway, if you've never done an iOS beta test, you should try it because it's actually pretty easy. Like, there's no sort of technical expertise required other than sort of knowing how to follow a link and dealing with the App Store a little bit. And then once you get one test flight, every other test flight from any other iOS application from any developer works exactly the same way. So then you can become like all of us in this program, and half our applications have a little colored dot next to them because we're on a million different betas.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Is one thing you'll notice is on your home screen on Springboard, there's, what is it, an orange dot, if memory serves?
It's blue when it's just been updated.
Yep.
Yes. Yep. And so you'll see a little dot next to the app, and that's normal. But yeah, I think this could be fun. I think it'd be it'll be a neat experiment. My intention sitting here now is to let this go until I release the app. And then no matter what, when I release the app, I plan to kill all this off, but I am making no guarantees. So if you, like, sign up for membership, I love you. I appreciate that. But you might have access for a day, an hour, a week, or maybe a month or two. I am making no promises. I just want to make that extremely clear. I don't want anyone to have their feelings hurt if this goes away quickly, but we're going to give it a shot and see what happens. I thought it would be kind of fun. So go into the membership panel if you are a member. If you're not, atp.fm/join. In that membership page, you can see, again, the ATP store discount code for you and a link to the test flight beta, which is also just for you and the fellow listeners.
And if you're wondering where the link to your membership page is, if you go to atp.fm/store, the link is there in the little paragraph explaining how to get your discount code. The other thing that you can do from Test Flight, by the way, is if you're testing this application and you have some feedback for Casey, right inside the Test Flight application itself.
No, not so much. Not so much.
I don't do that.
He turns off. Right,
no, because there's no good way to, like, you have to go through App Store Connect and dig through. It's terrible.
I know. I'm aware. I accept feedback through that on my beta.
Hold on. Slow down. So I turned it off specifically for this group. So the way Test Flight works is you can have several groups of testers. And so I made an ATP members group, which this link is associated with. And that group alone does not have the ability to do feedback. And if I'm completely honest, it's not that I don't care about the feedback, but I'm already kind of overwhelmed with feedback from the testers I already have, almost all of whom are friends or whatever. But nevertheless, even still, I have enough users now, even before all this, that I'm pretty overwhelmed by the feedback. And I didn't want to make it worse on myself. And I knew that if I got a fire hose of feedback from listeners, I would just be apt to shut the whole thing down. And I didn't want to do that. And that's not to say that I'm not interested in feedback, but I can only take but so much. And so what John is talking about, though, it is pretty slick. I haven't done this in a while, but if memory serves, if you take a screenshot of an app that you've installed via Test Flight, and if this thing is enabled, which again, it is not for members, I'm sorry, then what it'll do is it'll pop up a screen that says something like, you know, do you want to send this to the developer? Describe what you were doing at the time. I think it'll even let you annotate it. I think, again, it's been a while since I've done this, but it is pretty cool what you can do. And then that's all excellent. But the problem comes, and this is what Marco was driving at, to get to that information. First of all, you never get notified as a developer when somebody has given you feedback. Secondly, to get to that feedback, you have to dig through App Store Connect, which is the
you can't
website.
Do it in Xcode. I'm pretty sure you can do it. For Mac apps, you can do it in Xcode.
Oh, maybe you can. I don't know.
Go to the
I've
organizer and then look next to crashes. There should be a feedback item. Again, I don't know if this is true for iOS, but for Mac apps, you can get it there.
Really?
Well, if that's the case, that's news to me.
Do the little command.
I'm trying.
Command
I'm opening
Xcode. Shift O, whatever the hell the thing is for organizer.
Hold on. I got to switch floppies. Give me a second.
Oh, yeah. Xcode, yeah. It takes a few seconds to open up. It's. This computer's too slow. I need a new one.
I'm still running Xcode. I used to run the release version of my apps, or then I would run the Test Flight ones when I'm in the middle of Test Flight. But then a bug appeared in my app yesterday, and I was like, "Damn it! If I was just running this through Xcode, I could hit a breakpoint, right?" So now I'm just running my app in Xcode all the time, just in case this bug reappears. Then I can go grab a breakpoint. So yeah, Xcode is always running on my computer because I have a lot of RAM. But yeah, check out Organizer. You can see. Feedback.
Wait, where is it?
It's go to Organizer.
Under reports, crashes?
Feedback.
Oh,
yeah.
Feedback.
Under reports.
Feedback. Look at that.
Who knew?
Oh, I mean, the interface is hilarious.
Where
it says you can click the email button? If you do an email, it'll compose an email on your email client with the quoted text of their thing. But like, I think the most fun thing is when you, if you double click one of these feedback items, look at the interface.
It's terrible.
It shows a capsule with an X in it, and that's how you go back. Like if you hit that little X capsule,
that's
it says showing
really
one feedback.
Weird.
I don't know who made this. I don't know if I've ever seen a computer before, but it is there.
Oh my
it does
god!
Work.
I had no idea this was a thing.
You can see what device they're stuff. On, what notes they wrote. You can mark it as resolved.
Oh my god! This is great.
This was worth the proof. Okay, I'm shutting the Test Flight down because I've got what I'm needing.
Can I respond?
you can see the button that says email Joe Schmo at the top.
Look at that.
Where it says tester name.
Whoa, and if you hit that email button, it puts in a whole
bunch of
data.
It'll compose an email and it'll quote the text or include the text from their thing. Yeah.
This is amazing. This is so cool. John, I love you. I hand
and
God,
if you scroll
up
the top there, see under reports, it has another item called crashes that you might want to look at.
No, the, yeah, that I've the
you're aware
I've
of that
seen.
One. All right. Just
yeah, crashes,
sure.
You know, the battery usage, all that stuff. That I'm very aware of.
I always see the Hangs item. I'm like, oh, that's just for iOS, isn't it? I'm pretty sure Hangs is not for the Mac.
It's probably Man, mostly for
it says, Hangs logs amazing. Are not available for macOS apps. Wah, wah.
Yeah, because macOS apps never hang.
Yeah.
Especially calendar.
Energy logs are not available for macOS apps. Come on, Macs have batteries. What the hell?
yeah,
disk write right. logs are not available for macOS apps, but crashes are.
Yeah, it's most the well, crashes this... are mostly WatchKit. It's like every time I go to the crash thing, it's always like, all right, here's like three or four crashes from the iOS app and 40 different crashes from WatchKit, all within like UIKit core and everything. You know, the stuff that's not even my code.
Well, you should write a Mac app, and all your crashes will be in KVO. At least that's where all my crashes are.
All right, stop it there. We're done.
Yep,
perfect.
That's it. That's good.
Because we're running long. All right, titles.
All right, let's see what we got.
Just say no to KVO.
Jesus.
I put a GUI in for that. In that, by the way. You should open up my settings in the latest version of my app and look at the advanced setting windows that I added. It's hilarious.
Which one? Switch glass?
Yeah. Settings, then advanced. Because you know you have a pro app when you have an advanced settings.
How the fuck do I even get to settings?
It's in the menu bar icon.
Oh, okay. There you go.
I basically exposed almost all my hidden plist keys in a GUI just because I was sick of emailing people about them.
Yeah, that's kind of where I have my nitpicky details in Overcast. Like, that's yeah. basically mm-hmm. like, here's a checkbox.
Use polling instead of KVO. Oh, my mm-hmm. God.
That? You have that? In, oh, my God.
I didn't put all of them in there. There are still a few hidden, but I put most of them in there.
That's incredible. Amazing. So honestly, I know this is not for the show because now we're over time, but I've been using a lot more combined publishers I've been rewriting Overcast's
Ooh,
whole bottom
No, no, no,
half.
Save it for the show. No, we got to save it for the show because this could be
Case
fun.
He loves to hear about Combine.
Yes, I do.
He loves to hear about the Combine in City 17. Tell him all about it.
That's different. That's a different thing.
Are you sure? It seems like it might be the same.
I have all these like, you know, type erased publishers all over the place and I'm kind of enjoying
that's
it.
That's a little annoying, but yeah.
Let me tell you about publish and subscribe, boys.
Well, the crazy right. thing with what I'm doing is the whole new architecture I'm doing, most things that are not touching the UI are thread agnostic and async. So I got stuff going on all sorts of threads, and it doesn't matter. And it's kind of cool.
You must be, and I'm not trying to be funny, you must be using actors the way they're supposed to be used, I would assume, because I am really, that's where I'm really weak on the async stuff, is I kind of sort of understand actors, but I don't think I've really properly embraced it yet. And so maybe you should tutor me at some point.
I'm using only one actor so far. It's the one inside of Blackbird. Blackbird uses an actor to protect its SQLite handle from concurrent access.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So that's kind of I call it the core of the database, and it's like there's a whole bunch of API calls that you can either do the async, or if you do a transaction, it'll do it on the actor, and then you can just pass the core to all these features, and it'll do them all synchronously, all these different functions. So that's kind of the architecture there. So I can do stuff synchronously with Blackbird if I do it inside of a transaction on the actor. Otherwise,
SQLite is still single threaded, right? No concurrent access to SQLite databases.
You can do it. There are ways to do it, but it's ideal if you don't. Like ideally, it's.
I don't mean concurrent readers. I mean concurrent writers.
As far as I know, there are no concurrent writers. No, it uses locks to protect against.
I was just wondering if that's ever going to change, but yeah, that simplifies things for you a little bit.
Totally. Yeah. So
you have a serial queue for your database writes. That's inefficient. Well, it's SQLite.
Yeah, and also SQLite is super fast. So like it's basically like whatever you're doing to. You know, like if you are actually limited by SQLite's write speed and you've already done things like, you know, put things in transactions and you know, tweak some of the settings, stuff like that, like if your bottleneck is SQLite's write speed, you're doing something very wrong, probably.
No, you just have a lot of data. I think I told you when I was trying to use SQLite as my test database for my big thing, you get a few million rows in a SQLite, the writes slow down real quick.
Yeah, but again, like you're probably not doing that in an iOS app. Like that's.
I don't know. You think about it. I was doing this on my like PowerPC Mac Pro at my job. I was using it as my stand-in for a real Oracle database, and very quickly found out what the limits on SQLite are because it just really does not expect you to have millions of rows. It's just not made for that. But it works great right up until it absolutely doesn't.
All right, titles, focus.
I suggested a modification of the one that Casey put in. The meat part of multitasking instead of
that
meat
is
part
better
of
yeah
Yeah, that's fine. That's fair. I'll never be RAM hungry again is obviously.
I don't want to kill that one.
All right, fair.
Do you know, do either one of you know what that's from?
Gone with the Wind.
Good job, Casey.
You know,
Marco,
why
have you ever seen Gone with
no,
the Wind?
I've never seen it. I looked it up. That's why.
All right. So both of you heard of it. Casey knows what it's from. Neither one of you have seen it.
Correct.
No, I knew it was from because I looked it up.
You looked it up.
Yes, I looked it up.
Well, there you go. There you go.
I wanted to impress you just for a moment.
I thought it was plausible that one of you would know what it's from, but I didn't think either one of you had seen it. You should watch it. I mean, I know, you know, you think it's going to be old and it's way longer than you think it is, but it's actually worth watching at least once.
I tried to watch Citizen Kane many years ago and I hated it and I couldn't make it through.
Well, I mean, Gone with the Wind is probably going to be a similar experience, honestly, but.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Depression era computing resources is, I'd suggest it, but it's very good.
I do like if I only had a petabyte. I like the, let's see.
The meat part of
Ghost of its former
is good.
Self, I think, was my favorite one that I submitted. John said it. I also
what
like,
was that about?
The Ghost Disk floppy disk icons. You can run Mini VMac or now actually go to like what is it called? Like the I know System 7 dot app. What it's probably System 6 dot.
Yeah, I've seen what you're talking about. Like I know I've seen it before. Like in I really enjoyed Where the Internet Go. That's a very good.
That
one.
Actually that is very good. That might be my favorite. In fact, Where'd the Internet Go? But I do like the meat part of multitasking. I do like if I only had a petabyte. Did I spell that right, by the way? I'm not sure I did.
Yeah, go to System6app. In your web browser, System, the number 6 dot app. It will show you a System6 Mac, and you'll have some floppy drives. Go click on one of the hard drives, and then go select eject from the file menu.
Can't I just drag it to Command the trash? D. Yeah, I can drag it to the trash.
You can drag it to the trash, too. Well, then you'll see the ghost. It becomes a ghost.
No, it disappeared.
Eject is unmounted. You got to do eject. I guess you unmounted it by dragging to the trash. Well, hit reload on the web browser. Click the infinite HD and go to file and select eject, and you'll see it ghost out.
Yeah, it becomes just
it's poorly dithered because it can't be the same dither as the background because the background is every other dot. That's the gray that you see in the background.
Oh, so it's like every kind.
So this is like every third dot, and it just never looked great. Monochrome. No grayscale. Pixels are on or off. It's all you need.
It is hilarious how quick this thing boots, by the way, because it is instant.
You know, it's running in a web browser. It's so sad. I know.
Yeah, anyway, you see the boot screen. It just flicks. And
what are we going with? I think my favorite is, maybe Where'd the Internet Go is my favorite, but all the ones that you guys have.
I think the meat part of multitasking is my favorite.
I'm good with that, too.
I can do that.
Marco?
Yep.
All right. The meat part of multitasking.
It's you.
You are the meat.
You're the other white meat.
Baby, the other.
I wonder if I still can do the floppy disk swap. I should take out one of my old things to see if I still got it in. I think my hands are too old, too big and old now. I need like my child hands, you know.
Do you still have both, you know, a computer that can do that works and also floppy disks that still work?
What kind of question is that?
I know you have stuff in your attic, but have you tried it? Does
I have
still
so
work?
Many up there that I'm sure one of them works. And yes, of course, I have all my floppy disks.
I mean, I know your attic is a carefully controlled environment.
Mm-hmm. It's just a numbers game. I just have so many computers that take floppy disks, and I have so many floppy disks that the answer to that has got to be yes. One of those computers still works, and one of those floppy disks still works.
Hey, off topic, Marco, there's a couple of places where you're probably going to want to take a slightly closer look than normal at the show notes. I know you always look through them, but there's a link or two that you might want to change. And also the way I handled the sponsored by, if you want to switch that up, that's totally fine. Just I know you always look through it, but you're probably going to want to take a finer toothed comb than normal for this week.
Yeah, I got it. Marco, affiliate link here. Thank you.
I had one. The only late breaking link I had. Did you see the ones that have been linked? Did you see the Tobor link?
No,
that
I did
pulled?
Not. The, which one?
Tobor. It was from the.
Oh,
the
I did. Yes,
Kobo.
I did put the Tobor one in, and
yeah,
I didn't
it.
Put the library book, the Tobor library book, but I did put the former, the 2021.
The Tobor one is the one that I wanted in there.
Yep.
Because otherwise, the people are going to be telling me that it's not an incomparable reference. Actually, it's a reference to a commercial. I know it's a commercial we talked about on The Incomparable.
Oh, that's the secret.
Yes.
But at this point,
we're watching the Star Wars holiday special with commercials. for the Incomparable.
Oh, and so that's awesome.
During the commercial break, this was a commercial that aired during the Star Wars Holiday Special.
Where did they find that? Like somebody had a VHS tape of it from when it aired?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I'm sure tons of people had it. It was the first time we talked about the Star Wars Holiday Special, the title of the episode was something that I said in the program, which was, I have to explain more context so you don't know this. Did you either watch MST3K?
I am aware of it, but I never saw it.
Yeah, I never really watched it.
That was a show that was popular, but not a lot of people could see it. And it was popular back in the days when people would pass around VHS tapes as a way to get people to see it. If you didn't have cable or Comedy Central, it was on. And so there was the thing that people say to each other was keep circulating the tapes, like keep passing the tapes around so more people can see MST3K. Just a sort of a sneaker net version of like piracy or whatever. Keep circulating the tapes, right? So we watched the Star Wars Holiday Special. And then we were talking about how that was similar. Like, it was so bad, but people recorded it and they were passing around. And my line for the show was, stop circulating the tapes. It's so bad. And so, yeah, that's how it, because people would pass that around as kind of like, you know, like a thing, something so bad, and we'd watch it and it would be hilarious and you'd show it at parties. Like, it was like the twisted and evil equivalent of like a stag film from bachelor parties back in the day, where they'd pass around like actual film footage of things you'd show at bachelor parties, right? This was the Star Wars Holiday Special. So yeah, and it came with commercials, and one of them was for Tobor.
Oy. Good story.
But Kobo should, I mean, I don't know what Kobo's advertising campaign is, but the Kobo should consider Kobo, its book spelled backwards.
For a fleeting moment, I thought that was true.
Makes a good ad. A lot of people will say, oh, that makes sense. Yeah, sure. And they'll say, wait a second.
That's exactly what I did. Truly.
It is. I do believe it is actually book scrambled up. Like, I think that is the inspiration of the name. It's a dumb name.
Yeah, what are you going to do?
All right, goodbye, some person's last name, Mr. Kobo.
It's better than books with an X on the end.
Books, yeah.
That is true.
That's something about the naming of, maybe they used all of the good names back when I was in the ebook biz. One of the first like hardware products for reading books was called the Rocket Book, I believe, which is better than book with an X.
Well, it's better. Like Sony had that line of pretty decent little e-ink readers, but of course they had Sony names. So it's like, you know, the Sony.
The MDX 5000 PQR.
Right. Yeah. It's like these totally unmemorable random garbage names.
It's amazing. They were the company that came up with the sensible console, PlayStation, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3.
Yeah, right.
They're the only company that did that. Microsoft's totally off the deep end on naming, and Nintendo does whatever the hell they feel like at any given moment. 64, Wii, Wii U, Switch. I don't know what. What? I mean, Nintendo and Super Nintendo, you're like, they finally got it. They'll do Mega Nintendo, Ultra Nintendo. Nintendo 64's code name was Ultra 64. So, like, Super Mega Ultra, like, okay, I can see they can do that. Nope.
Look, nobody has Microsoft beat. Like, call it, yes. The second Xbox, we're going to call it 360. The third one is going to call
one. Called one. and this one is called Series X, but we'll also have a Series S.
Right. Xbox One S Series X.
It is real bad. It is real
don't forget
bad.
The Kinect. Everyone wants to forget the Kinect.
Oh, God.
This is where Apple. This is where Apple gets it from. Like they have similar naming disease. Like, but Sony, like PlayStation. Like, I hope they never change that. I hope they do PlayStation 967. Like, just keep incrementing the number at the end. Fine, it works. Like, I mean, iPhone, I feel like we'll eventually. We've talked about this before. We'll eventually give up on the number when they get triple digits or whatever. But like. PlayStation 9. Well, I remember the ad. I remember the ad anyway. And bootleg listeners remember the ad. Marco and Casey do not remember the ad.
Nope. No idea what you're talking about.
You can Google a PlayStation 9 ad and you'll see it.
All right. Thank you for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.